This will be session one, tape one of an interview with Charles M. Newsom for the California State College Bakersfield California Odyssey Project by Michael Neely at 25199 Road 164, Visalia, California, 93277. On March 23, 1981, at 2 p.m.
Well, what's the first thing you can remember?
Well, back there, well, I was born in December 24th, 1926. The place where we was born, where I was born, the house, was on the White Ranch, what they call the White Place there. And now it has been tore down piece by piece and moved into the Fort Gibson Museum. And they have that for the relic of the early times, how the people lived there.
Outside of Fort Gibson?
Yeah, I was born just outside of Fort Gibson, Oklahoma. The earliest thing, my memories, is when we lived in Arizona, about 1929. I can remember finding a big chicken's nest over there where folks had went out there for 2 years and lived in Arizona in 29 and part of 30.
When did they move to Arizona?
Family problems, I guess. I don't know why. But there was times of hardship or something, and they went to Arizona and worked on a big cotton ranch there at Glendale, Arizona, which is across the street from Sun City now. And that's my earliest thing I remember. I have a picture standing there by this great big old saguaro cactus, and there's an old plow leaning up there, and hen's nest must have, I don't know how many eggs in it. That was the first, maybe just for relating to the picture, but I must have been 2.5 years old, 3. And that's the first thing I can remember, because I can't remember anything about that trip going to Arizona. But then, when we went back, my next memories there, we lived on a place that belonged to my aunt. And Dad had a big 6-horse team of mules that he worked on the road grader, grading roads, county roads and state roads there. And these old mules had to always be twitched. And I was just big enough to hold a twitch in a mule's nose while he harnessed them. Well, it's a thing you put on a mule's nose to put a bit in. You leave the halter bridle on him all the time because you can't play with his ears. You want to let you bridle him on the ears. You put this, it's a little piece of wood about yay long. It has a little looper rope, goes through the end of it. You reach up and twist it up on his nose and hold, you can hold him that way by. You let you get him by the nose, but you can't touch him by the ears.
The piece of wood's about a yard long.
Yeah, about 2 foot long. And then anybody, after you twitch it, or twist it, while anybody can hold it that way, and he'll stand real still while you put the bit in their mouth. And I can remember that. And he had an old dog that always went with him. He wasn't no kid dog. He strictly was Dad's dog. And my brother and I never did touch him.
What was the purpose of the dog?
Oh, it was just the dog. Dad owned the dog.
He wasn't anyone else?
No, he was strictly Dad. He's strictly a man's dog, and that's all he was.
You were saying one time your brother?
Was about 2 years old. And he got out of the yard and got out there in a pen of them mules, all of them chasing him around there. And they were, back then times, the mules just weren't no easy things like these horses these kids play with nowadays. They was really after him. And here I was running, screaming like a mad. I can remember that as if it was yesterday. About them mules after him in there in that horse pen, in a pen where they were kept. And then that must have been 31, somewhere around there. And then for keeping your milk and stuff, we had there was a sulfur well on the place for water for it come up real cold. And most sulfur wells are hot, but this one was real cold spring. And they had it fixed up where it went through this little building in a rock or whatever. That's where we kept all of our meat and milk and stuff that way. With cheap cream, you'd separate your cream and make butter to go to town, trade on Saturdays. Well, that's where they kept all that stuff.
So you say a sulfur well, had it been dug out?
No, it was a spring. It was just a spring came up. The well, they had dug the well and the well water was good, but this sulfur spring came up right out of the ground. And it was cold, because most of them are hot, but that one's cold, as my memory remembers.
Did it come up in a flat place, or?
Came up just out of a crevice of a rock, a little rocky cliff, probably 20 foot high.
How far was it from the house?
Oh, 100 feet, something like that. That's my memory. Because we went back visiting in 1938. Why, we went and checked all that stuff out. We went around that way. And my brother and I walked down from an aunt's house up on top of the hill about 3 miles away to this place, and went down there to see if our memory was good on that thing down there, what we had remembered about. And today, well, there's an old gal lives on that place that if you turn into it, why, first thing you know, there's a big rifle bullet goes flying over your car. Because we found that out last time I was back there. Wife and I was going to go back and look at the place there. Shoot, we turned up this lane overgrown it just big enough for a car to go down through there. Next thing, this old gal was at the end of it and with a gun pointing down that way, and we decided we didn't want to go talk to her, none at all.
But, why did you was it normal to have problems with the mule?
Oh, no, all mules were broke that way. They were, most of them. It's very unusual, I would say, that you had a team of mules you didn't have to do it that way. Because they were just, at least all the mules my dad ever had. That's why he never did work mules too much.
How would he break mules?
I don't know how he broke them, but everybody else did. I guess broke them. I don't remember that. But he'd take them up there, and our grandfather worked mules all the time. But Dad, most of the time, worked horses. I know I've learned how to drive a team of horses. I'll never learn how to drive, work with no mules, because Dad had horses all the time.
Were horses easier to work with than mules?
All depended on whether you believed in working mules or working horses. Each had its own following. The old saying is that you can't ever work a mule to death, but a horse will kill himself working. Because mules have more sense than to work yourself to death. But it was all dependent. But that was the only time I can ever remember my dad owning mules.
What was your father like back then?
Oh, what was he like? He wasn't a great big man. He was probably 150 pounder, 5'10". And Paul, I think, was one of the more better respected men in the country back there at the time.
Why was that?
Well, he was always a deputy sheriff or a constable that way. If there was troubles, why, they always come looking for Hove.
For who?
For Hove. That was his name.
Hove?
Yeah.
H-O-B?
Yeah, it was short for Hove. And they, we'll say two guys up in the mountains got in a fight or something, or, why, if you get in trouble, well, they'd always come looking for my dad. And evidently, he was fairly well respected that way. And, well, I don't know, he never did have anything to speak of, but it was just one of those things, you know. Some people in neighborhoods are that way and some aren't.
What was his temperament like?
Very easy, until he got mad. And then he could, when he got mad, he could tear your hind end off. But he was a fellow that you could push him as well, long, long ways before he would fight or get mad. He had a very... very level tempered, and but when you pushed him over the ramp, why, my brother always knew when it was, because he could sure tear your hind end up right quick. But you had to push him a long ways, you know, to ever get him over that ramp. He didn't have a short, quick temper like a lot of people do.
Did he carry a weapon when he went out?
Oh yeah, I have an old gun that he used to carry.
What was it?
Colt thumb peacemaker. But
44?
No, 45. But he didn't ever need that. Heck, he could use to take care of troubles without that back in those times. And those that you need a tougher one, go get the big boys and let them take care of them. He didn't need to go. But he could pretty well take care of herself. Like one time, that's quite a bit later. But we had firewood when my brother and I was carrying it in. And Bill tripped in this piece of hickory. And you just take an axe and lop them off, the limbs off when it gets down like that. Well, you don't mean to split it. Why, he'd lop these off and left the real sharp thing sticking out, and it went up under Bill's eye. When he fell with it, why, hit that stub, hit up under his eye there, cut it open. And he took a needle and silk thread and took a chimney coal oil lamp and held the needle over it. And I don't know, I guess it sterilized. Anyway, he held it over a pair of pliers until it was almost red hot. And then let it cool back down and took that needle and threaded it and put two stitches in his eye, and that's the only way he ever went to the doctor. He has very little scar from it to this day from doing that. But he had been in the medics in World War I, served a couple of years in the medics, and he could do about anything that way. Didn't doctor and livestock, he could take and go out and sew up a cow or a hog, get tore that way, while dogs after it or wolf or something, got a hold of it. He could take and fix that up all right.
Did the neighbors call him for help?
Yeah, it seemed like he was done. He worked the way he did. Yeah, he'd go help people out that way and do different things. I don't remember it, but that was before I was born. He must have been the chief barber around the country because he finally had to quit because everybody in the country come on and cut their hair. on Saturdays, and didn't want to pay anything. And shoot, by the time you get your scissors or sharpener and keep a pair of clippers up, he got tired of it and said, no more of that nonsense. I can't afford it. Said, I want rest too. And they used to go play ball. Now, this was before I was born. They'd drag it in their wagons and drive off 25 miles, 30 miles to some other town somewhere and play ball. And he had a guy that had his leg off just below the knee that was a catcher. And this old boy would take, and they'd get in. Usually they'd go there and dance all Saturday night and drink. And then Sunday morning they'd go to playing ball and quit in time to get home, maybe to go to work Monday morning, and usually end up in a fight or something. And anyway, this old boy, that leg off, when the fight got started, he'd just back up against the backstop and jerk his old peg leg off, and he could whale him up pretty good. So I'd always heard, anyway. I never seen it, but I've always heard that tale, that where the old guy had that peg leg. When he backed up against the backstop and jerked that leg off, watch out.
What was your mother like back then?
Oh, she was more of a nervous individual and still is than Dad ever was. And they didn't get married until fairly late in life. Dad was 31 when I was born, and Mom was 30.
What year were they married?
In 1921. And they'd been married 5 years before I was born. So they...
How many brothers?
I only have one brother. I don't know why. I don't know why they didn't have a big family. Mom was old now, and she wished she had a whole bunch of kids. But that's the way life is. But... Oh, she was a woman who weighed 140 pounds when she was young, and I guess at that time wasn't too bad a looking woman. She's old and bent over now, but she's not that bad of a looking woman. She's not, you don't know Elizabeth Taylor, but Elizabeth Taylor may look that bad or worse when she's 83 too. But
is she a hard worker?
Yeah, they always worked, and back there, I can later on. Many years later, canned fruit, we canned vegetables and everything like that, and put it up that way, and she did all that kind of work, you know, and do all the laundry by the rub board. I can remember helping doing that.
How did she do that?
You never seen a rub board? It's a little piece of metal about 14 inches wide and about 2 foot long. It has two legs, the last 8 or 10 inches on those two legs, and then it's in waves. You take that and put it in a tub, number 3 wash tub, and you take it and your knuckles and rub it back up over that way until you get your clothes cleaned that way.
What kind of detergent do you use?
Oh, the detergent at that time? Wasn't no such thing as just plain old yellow lye soap. And we used to make the soap when we killed hogs that way.
Was that soap any good?
Oh, I guess we thought that was all soap we had. We must have been pretty good. But we thought it was all right anyway. Well, all I remember is that we had a big old kettle that to heat the water in. We get through, you'd put lye and some part of the lard in it or something, and boil it until it hardened in it, harden up, and you'd go out and cut it up, and you'd have caked yellow soap that way. And then they did buy, I guess they did buy some soap for a kitchen. I don't know, but don't remember that. But I remember making that lye soap that way.
What else about your mom?
Oh. Well, let's see.
Remember how she dressed?
Yeah. She used to have a, when we come to California, she'd give it away. But she had a full, whenever she'd rode horseback, because she was quite a horsewoman. And she had a full-length leather split skirt that she wore riding horseback. I mean, when you'd walk one, it would almost drag the ground. Full, it was solid, it was big, heavy leather stuff. And that way, and other than that, I don't remember ever wearing jeans before we came to California. I always wore a dress, kind of long below her knees. But I don't think, back them days, I don't think women wore pants out much that way. But she did have that old big leather skirt that she wore that way. And
did she ride a horse very much?
Yeah, when she was a young girl, when she was a young girl, I came into that country there. That goes back just after the turn of the century. Her folks run a lot of cattle there. In that country in there, and just before World War II, I guess she was about as good a cow gal as it was in that country back there, because her and her dad would go all over that country with 7,500 miles away from home and gather up cattle and bring them home all the time and every year that way. And so she did ride a horseback, and And later on, just before we came out here, I can remember while we was going to a thrashing crew, Dad always worked in the summer running a thrashing crew, and all would be gone all 6 days a week and come in on weekends. And so we was going over to a cousin's where they was thrashing that day, and we had this big old gray mare, and so we were going to ride over there, and Mom went out, and she wouldn't let me ride the horse. I used to go, all three had to go on one horse that day. And so I got out there, and we got the saddle on old Minnie, and Mom crawled up, and then she got Bill up behind and told me to crawl up. Every time I'd get on, old Minnie would start kind of humping up a little bit. She's so dang big old perching mare. She couldn't get her hind end off the ground. Perching the mare, and she'd kick her hind end up a little bit. And I heard all day going about 8 miles would slide off. Every time that old horse would hump up a little bit, Mom would say, slide off, slide off. And I'd walk most of the way going that trip instead of horseback riding. Well, she's trying to buck and didn't want to. My little brother was in between us, and he was always kind of delicate, being the little brother always, whether he was delicate or not, and she wasn't going to get him thrown. But every time the little horse acted like he was going to buck, I'd slide off over the back end.
You call that horse Minnie?
Yeah, she was a part of the team that Dad had. We had a team of mares there, Maud and Minnie.
They were pretty large horses.
Yeah, they would have weighed 1,500. The Minnie would have weighed 1,500, Maud probably 1,400. Maud was a thoroughbred and crossed with something else. I don't remember what it is, but she wasn't an all workhorse. She was could have been rode. We used her for riding horse quite a bit.
Was it unusual to have that kind of horse?
No, I don't think so. They were a good team of horses, though, good team of mares and everything. But that was as good a team of horses as we ever had, I guess. Because when we came out here in 35, Dad sold them for $500, him and a harness, and that was a lot of money at that time. But
the good team was quite an asset.
Yeah, it was making a living or not. But long before that, that was from the mules, it's probably 5-6 years. But when I first then left there, I went started to school. First school I went to was the Menard School.
Menard?
Yeah, M-A-N-E-A-R-D. And it was off of a little town called Perkins. And Perkins was a grocery store and a filling station, and we run it. Yeah, my mom run it during the daytime, and when she had time, when she'd get through doing her housework, she'd go down and open that up. And they had, it was just out in the country where them old wild hillbilly boys that wouldn't go to town would come, and they'd buy stuff there instead of going to town. Because I can remember him coming down out of the hills, four or five of them, and one would come in and get his cotton bowl twist tobacco.
His what?
Cotton bowl twist tobacco.
Cotton bowl twist.
Yeah, that's a piece of tobacco about that long, bent around, and then it's all twisted up.
About a foot and a half long.
Yeah, and it's real strong. And they'd come in and get a twist of that, and these other guys would all stay way back off, 100 yards out away from the place, and when he got through buying what he wanted, he'd go back up, and another one would come down.
Why was that?
I don't know. I guess they was wild. We called them wild and mean. Well, my mom, them dudes would come in, she told us to hide out back in the pantry somewhere. Us boys was told to get hid out.
Were they mean?
I don't know. I guess so. I just told us they were mean, so I took them in what they said. I didn't mess with them.
Were they armed?
Oh, yeah. Every one of them had a rifle. They'd come in. They didn't go around nowhere. They didn't have a rifle with them. But I don't even remember their names or what, but they come back out of them hills from somewhere.
Mother have a weapon in the store?
I don't remember. Dad always had a weapon around the home though somewhere, but as far as in the store, I don't know. But I know we were a lot more afraid of them when they came in than we were the time that Pretty Boy Floyd come by and bought gas.
Do you remember that?
I can remember Dad Mom talking about it. She knew when she went to get the gas, where she knew who it was and told us to stay in the store, and we stayed inside. We didn't come out. We were pretty well trained at that time. We didn't. Later on, we got where we didn't mind that good, but at that stage, we minded good.
Was there any more to the story than that?
No, not that they just come in and got a tank of gas, and I guess the gas would have been maybe a dollar, and they left a $10 or $20 bill. Down the road they went, and as I remember, there was five of them in an open touring car.
How did the people feel about it?
Well, I don't know what the rest of them felt. I never heard them talk. I was too little to remember what the rest of them thought. I know my mom was scared. That's the only thing I can remember, is that she was scared at the time.
She didn't call the police?
Well, no phone. Didn't have no phone or nothing to call anybody. After they left, there was about lunchtime, and Dad came in, and she told him about it. And one of them said, "Well, what happened?" She said, "Well, nothing. They just bought gas and gave me whatever money it was." And he said, "Well, if they come back again, we'll do the same thing. Just don't get excited about it and let it go."
Well, the reason I asked, I've heard stories that people respected Pretty Boy Floyd because he was...
Well, they could have, but I don't remember that part of it. I don't remember whether they did or not or anything that way. But
what was your house like back then?
Well, where we lived in, at that place, it was just a frame house.
Well, help me see it.
Well, there was all that was white, painted white. And my memory was four rooms because we had the school teachers lived in there with us. And the room, school teachers slept around behind the kitchen. The house, the kitchen faced west, I believe. Yeah, faced west. And that was the entrance into the house. And then you went out of that into a great big room and went, turned to your right and went around, and there was a bedroom there. And we, at that time, we were boarding these two school teachers. One of them was real tall and slim, as I remember it, and one of them was kind of short and heavy set. And every time my mom, my folks would get on through me to correct me after they'd been a while there, I was smart little duck. I'd run to them school teachers, and they'd say, "Now, Joe, don't, that's all right, just leave them alone. He didn't do anything." They'd stand between me and getting licking many times.
Your father's name was Joe?
No, my mother's name was Joe, for Josephine, was shortened to Joe. And these teachers would tell her, "Now, Joe, that's all right, he didn't do nothing wrong." Man, whatever I did, didn't matter what. I run to them. It didn't take long to run to them teachers to get out of the way.
What kind of kitchen did you have?
Well, wood stove and just a table, and that's all I can remember about it. And I think that they'd had a heat water in it at that time because it was a big old... I heard my dad and mom talk about it later. It was a Franklin stove, and I guess that was the one extravagance that they did buy when they got married, that he went to town and bought her a Franklin cook stove, and I guess it was the fanciest thing that ever was made that way, and we had it until we came to California. We moved it and had it until we came out here. But
how did you keep your water in the kitchen?
Have a well. You usually have a dug well outside somewhere and windlass up over it, and you let the... It would have either rock build up around it or boards, and then it would have a lid over it, some kind of opening which you could open and close, and a windlass over it and a bucket, and you'd let a bucket down in and get your water. Fill your bucket up and take it in the house, and you kept it just in on. As I remember, it was a wooden bucket that held 2.5-3 gallons of water.
You had a ladle in it?
Yeah, we always used a dipper. It wasn't a ladle, it was a dipper. We used a dipper, have a handle on it 15 inches long, and then that was how you got water out of the bucket in the house.
Was the water good?
Well, I thought it was good. My memory says that was the sweetest, best water I ever drank. I know when we went visiting back, the wife and I have, up until last year, we've been going back every year for the last 6, 7, 8 years with a travel trailer. And these cousins, I go back and I said, "Can't you guys go, let's go back on a hill somewhere and find one of those good cold springs of water?" Shoot, them guys, they don't know where no cold springs are, and they don't know where the wild onions grow anymore, or nothing. They've all got modern than we have out here. Because the first time I went, I just knew, man, we'd go back there and... It was 7 years ago. And these people never left there. Here they lived there, born there, and never left to do anything. I didn't go to the service. And I thought, man, the little LD will know right where all that good spring cold water is that we used to go out and get that way and think was so good. And I asked him, I said, "Well, where's that spring off over in such and such place over there?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I don't remember either." I said, "Well, yeah, it was over there. Back up there, back of the place on the creek over there, but toward where Wallace Huggins lived." I said, "I've been there. I wouldn't know whether it's there or not." And they didn't know nothing like it. Everything was that way.
How did you sleep?
Oh, we had regular bedsteads, iron bedsteads, as I remember, and feather mattress. I know my mom always had a feather bed, feather mattress on her bed.
Did she make it herself?
Oh, yeah. And I was number one goose catcher. Run the geese down and catch the geese first.
Oh, yeah, geese?
Oh, yeah. We kept always had anywhere from 10 to 10, usually around 10 old geese and one or two ganders, and let them lay and set and hatch every year, and then you sell them or eat them or whatever you want to do with the geese. But we always had enough geese to pluck to keep ourselves in feather beds and feather pillows. She made her own pillows of ticks and everything that way. And there was a knack, I guess, to it because she could make them and sell them once in a while. She'd have a real big feather bed and somebody in town didn't have no geese where she sold them once in a while that way.
Was there any particular way that she prepared the feathers?
Well, I don't know. That it would just use real heavy ticking and you pluck them at the right stage. We have to catch them when their feathers are just right. And I know me and my brother used to run them darn things down, and I've got a scar on my foot now from poor Sade running and jumping over a barbed wire fence trying to catch the damn things. And
weren't they pretty mean sometimes?
Oh, I guess they were, but we didn't pay no attention to them. We had our bluff on them. They didn't have their bluff on us, thank goodness. But anyway, we'd run these old geese down, and it seems to me like we had plucked them in the spring. Now, I can't remember that, but it seems as though it would have been in May. Or May wouldn't have been that. It would have been earlier. I guess it would have been the fall, because you wouldn't have plucked them after they'd been laying and setting all that, because they lost all their feathers. It must have been in the fall sometime when you'd run them down and catch them that way and pluck them, because the feathers would have been lost when they were setting, and they would have came in and been just, you know, they had to be just right or they didn't pluck them that way. I don't know what it was. I don't remember. But somehow or other, those feathers had to be just about right to...
How did you hold them? I mean, they didn't willingly cooperate.
Oh, no, you take one of them and you turn it. I've got too big a belly anymore, but like you are there, put your knees together. You take the old goose, stick his head out under your arm up there, and lay him right down on his back there, or put his head down here and his butt up in your tummy there, and you just jerk him right out, and you only pluck the place from his vent up between his legs, from where his vent is, up just in a little spot there probably.
You mean on his stomach?
Yeah, the vent there around, you know what the vent is, that's their rectal. The vent there, well, there's probably a place there, 5 inches across in a circle there that they plucked. That was about all they plucked. They didn't pluck the old goose. That's where all the good down was. That's where your good down feathers was right in front of the vent there.
It'd take quite a bit of plucking to get a mattress. Right?
Oh, yeah. To get a feather bed, it'd take 2 years plucking to make a good feather bed from what geese we had. And as I remember, we all slept in it, and you'd crawl in a feather bed, and it'd be freezing outside, jump in that thing, and you just settle down into it, and the old thing would just go up around you. I guess like getting in a waterbed about half full or third full. I've never been on a waterbed, but they'd just like that water would still come up around you, you know. And that's the way a feather bed would do. It just, after you jumped in it, the feathers would just float right up around you, and lock all the, you'd have all your warm in it, keep all the cold away from you that way.
How many people slept in a bed?
Well, my brother and I always slept together. And there was only two of us. My mom and dad slept together, and brother and I slept together, and that's all we ever did have. Or if we had company, so maybe a company kid visitor would come and sleep with us and that way or something. But that's all. We had two of us to bed until, I guess until I went in the service.
Did you have an outhouse?
Yeah, we had three holders and outhouses. We even had those after you come to California.
How far was, at that time, how far was the outhouse?
Dad was a stickler for that. That was one thing, was quite a ways from the house always. That was always a long walk. That was a good place to get an exercise, he said. He always wanted an outhouse a long ways from the house. And that was something we'd had to dig and move ever about twice a year, as I remember it.
Toilet paper hard to come by?
No, not if he was in good with Monkey Ward's. Then had a newspaper. I don't remember ever used. I think that's all they ever used was that. I don't remember newspaper, toilet paper being an outhouse back then. Maybe they did, but I don't remember. At school, maybe, but not there.
You had a barn?
Yeah, we had barns and everything. And
how far was the barn from
there? Well, the barn, the different ones. Now, this house where I first started the school up there on Bernard Creek, it was probably 100 yards from the house. And it was a great big tall hip roof barn. But we had big board fences around it. But we only lived up there 1 year. That's all we was up there. Dad rented a place up there 1 year. And then he came back and rented a place there on probably 8 miles from Fort Gibson and about 14 or 15 miles from where this Perkins was. And it belonged to my mother's dad and her sister, and he rented out. I think, as far as my memory was, that place comprised of 60 acres that he rented there.
You're going to talk about your brother?
No, where we went to school, started school before we left that place at Perkins. Well, this dog I told you about at first, well, that's where he got stolen, the mean dog that my dad thought so much of. Well, them old boys that come in the hills from that way, wow, they stole him there. They took and stole the dog.
What for?
I don't know why they stole him. Anyway, they stole the dog. And before they did, though, this stray cow came into our place there, and Dad was trying to run it off, and it never just wouldn't run off. It found a good place to eat, and it wasn't going back to where it looked like it'd been eating hot air and nothing else. And so Dad got this dog after one day, and last time we seen that old cow was whenever she went over the jump, come up and jump, started to jump the fence, and that old dog jumped up and caught her by the tail about a full foot from her butt. And when he hit the fence, he come back to the tail, and she kept going. That was the last time we ever seen the cow.
He took her tail off?
And he just cut her tail right off when she went over the fence. But so I don't know whether the cow went home or what. But anyway, that was the last time we ever seen that cow there. And these guys that stole the dog, the funny thing was they left one in return. They left the dog for us. They didn't steal it. When they steal something that way, you'd leave something in return.
Why would they take it off?
I don't know. They thought he was a good squirrel dog or something back in the hills they wanted him for.
Did they leave a pup?
No, they left a dog probably 2 or 3 years old. Anyway, I chased every Model T car that come down the road, he had chased that thing, and there wasn't too many cars, but he chased every one of them. And so somebody came down the road, and their dad was mad, didn't want the dog anyway, and he told the guy, well, if he'd do something about that dog, get rid of him. I don't know. And evidently, the guy knew. He went out and he got a tow sack, some kind, tied onto the hub of his car. And when he come by, that old dog grabbed out, and we didn't have no dog no more. That was the end of that dog.
Broke his neck.
Yeah, I did something to him. Anyway, that we didn't have that dog around no more. But then when we moved from there, we moved back down toward Fort Gibson down there, and we lived in a log house then.
What was it like?
It was kind of a lot longer than it was wide. As I remember, it was 3 rooms long this way. And then in the back, it had a great big, had a lean-to, the full length of it. And there was the kitchen was on the east end of it. And in the middle was we had a fireplace or a fire in there. And I guess it was a fireplace. And that's where heating was in the center section. And Mom and Dad slept on the west end, and then there was another bedroom in there somewhere, or living room where Bill and I slept. And then the summer, we slept out under the lean-to out there. It was enclosed. But that's where we would sleep outside then in the summertime.
Was that a nice place?
Oh, it was just an old log house. It was probably 100 years old when we lived in it.
Did your father buy it?
No, they were strictly renting it. And that might would have been 1933.
Do you remember what the rent was on?
No, I don't remember. I knew all the rent. I've got a card here where he borrowed $80, $100 to make a crop, and they gave him $80, and he paid back $120, 50% interest. They borrowed $80 to make a crop and live on for a year. And I've got somewhere around here, Emma's got it stashed around somewhere, that when we was going through stuff looking for genealogy stuff, well, we found that card and on that thing. But anyway, we had 3 years in a row. We had in this place there was what we call bottom land. It was probably 30 acres, 35 acres. It was down under a bluff down in there where the creek went down through there, and it was real good, rich land. And then up on top, up there, we raised cotton and oats up on top.
What's in the bottom?
Bottom was corn. And when the third crop year went floating down the river, that was when we decided to come to California. Third 3 years in a row in the Dust Bowl country, the corn was flooded out after he got it up ready to harvest. And
just unseasonal rain or something?
Well, we're the part of Oklahoma we come from, in the Ozarks there, there just was no dust storms. I've talked to since you first contacted me, I've had 3 cousins here that are in their 60s. And we've talked and really to some extent, and none of us ever remember any dust. We could maybe the little bit in the air once, those other 2 cousins could remember. But none of us ever remember having really what you would call dust storms or dust bowl days. Or at around Fort Gibson, where we came from. in the hills there. And but what it was, we were on this Menard Bayou. The Arkansas River would drain way off up in Colorado or somewhere in Arkansas or Kansas, and then the floodwaters come down and back up in the bayou there, and would flood our place out. And that's how it flooded it out those 3 years.
So it created enough hardship.
Hardship or just aggravation. I can remember riding the horse out there, and Dad wading water waist deep, and he'd somehow or other, I don't know why, he shocked the corn. Instead of 1 year we went through and picked it by hand after the flood, but the other 2 years he'd shocked it for some reason.
What is that?
Cutting it off and standing it up in shocks, probably 4 rows, 40 or 50 foot long, standing up in one spot and that way. And why he did it, I don't remember, but it was done that way. And I can remember riding the one horse, and he'd have two tow sacks tied together hanging over the weathers of the horse. And while I would take he would pick those two tow sacks full off of a shock, and while I would take that up house and dump it in a corn crib, he'd be get one full, and I'd just change horses. And I can remember doing that winter, that happened in September when that flood hit that last one. And I can remember that just like it was yesterday, riding that old Minion mud back and forth to the corn crib, dumping that in there, and Dad down there and up to his waist, a little over in that water, getting that corn out of there. But that's the way of, well, I guess the way of one life that way. But we always had, we had about 50 head of Jerseys and I guess white-faced cross, mostly Jerseys, cattle that were out on open range, and milked them and brought them in, and always have a bunch of yearlings there. And you'd let the old cows out and feed them of the night when they'd come in, let the calves suck them of the night. And so the cows would always want to come back home. But it was my job always to get on a horse and go and get them and bring them in of an evening, because they usually didn't. They'd get within 2 or 3 miles, something like that, 3 or 4 miles. And you'd have to go get them on there, or they would be all night getting there. But what milk we could get from them of a morning, we separated it. Mom would churn it, or hell, we all churned it, because I can remember standing at a 5-gallon churn that way and running a dasher up and down that blooming thing. And
churn was made out of wood?
No, it was a crock made out of some kind of stone. I guess, anyway, well, it was 10 inches in diameter, 2 foot tall, and we used have a cross in it, and a handle up through it went up through a hole in the center up the top, and you just take and churn the butter, and then she had a mold. As I remember it, was all every woman that took butter in and traded that way, well, they had their own mold, and I think there were 2 pounds. The one that Mom has in town now is a 2-pound mold, but it has a floral design that each woman had their own design, and it would be molded onto the butter. And some people, that's the only butter they would buy in town, and you never churned on Friday, because you always took fresh cream in, and when you sold the butter, well, you had a little fresh cream. Thinking back on it, well, that was so people could buy fresh cream to have whipping cream on Sunday and Saturday or something. That must, the only reason it must have been. But you never had to churn on Friday. You always took fresh cream when you went to town Saturday morning with half a case of eggs and 10 or 15 pounds of butter and maybe 4 or 5 old hens to trade for what you needed that week or something, or just to sell and try to get some money. Well, you always took that fresh cream in on Friday and Saturday. You never did churn Fridays. And if it was weather was good, well, you didn't churn Thursday because of the fact that the cream would sell fresh that way.
Do you remember what it was worth?
No, I don't have any. I do remember this. The first Farm Journal I ever seen, guy traded it for 2 Dominicker chickens. A year subscription. The first Farm Journal I ever seen was he took 2 chickens off down the road. But I do remember that.
What, can you remember list off the animals you had on your farm?
Well, we had team of workhorses, and then we had a riding horse that I rode all the time and Dad rode. And we usually had anywhere from 10 sows, maybe more, but always anywhere from 8 to 10 sows, because Dad took the corn and fed out hogs in the winter and sold fat hogs. And anywhere from 35 to 40 head of 50 head of cattle that run on open range. And stuff, and well, we wasn't the rich Okies, and we wasn't the poor ones, but we were kind of average.
How about
Oh, chickens. Oh, we had chickens all the time.
What kind?
Well, I remember it was Plymouth Rocks and Rhode Island Reds. They were always either Barred Rocks or Plymouth or Red. And once in a while, Mom, she wanted a bunch of land chickens, but she'd get her some white leghorns. But we usually end up with dang hogs. Like one time I had an uncle that came, my mom's oldest brother. We had an old sow that every time chicken get in her pen, why, she'd kill that chicken. I mean, she was death on chickens. And so Dole Uncle Jim came out there, and he was an outlaw, tough one of the family. He was always a tough nut.
How old was he then?
Oh, this was in 1935, and he would have been 50, somewhere 55. He was born in 1888, I think, somewhere around there, 1880 or 1890. But anyway, he came out, and he went off back in the hills there, right off up from the house, whole 200-300 yards. It was started up into the hills there, and he went off up in there and shot a hawk. And somehow or other, he wounded it. I don't know how he did it, but he must have been good enough shot that he just shot and broke this hawk's wing and brought it in and threw that hawk in there where that old sow was, and when she never did kill the hawk, but she didn't kill no more chickens either. The hawk taught her that somehow or other, while balling up on it and pecking its eyes and nose that way, why, he said, well, I'll go get a hose and break this chicken-eating sow. And I can remember, I thought, well, boy, what's he talking about?
You mean he did it on purpose?
Oh, no, he did it for my dad, just did it to do it, you know. And he went back, and he was a good enough shot with a handgun or with a rifle, either one. And he had lost his wife in the flu epidemic of 1919. And he had four children that his mother was raising, and he lived in Tulsa, and always was a machinist and always had a good job. He never did get without a job up there. And so he'd come down to the ranch that way, and he'd go squirrel hunting, he'd take a squirrel hunting and do things like that. And he was always a good shot with that gun.
What kind of gun was that?
I don't know, some kind of rifle. And he always carried he had a pistol he carried too all the time, and he could knock a bird out of the top of the tree with it anytime he wanted to. But we us kids always thought when Uncle Jim come, why, man, he'd go kill squirrels, he'd go shoot a squirrel. My dad never did like squirrels. Squirrels cook squirrel anyway, but Mom and Dad, and we thought it was the greatest when Uncle Jim would come and go kill a squirrel, and we'd have squirrel dumplings for night or something.
Did you go with him when he went?
Oh, yeah. My brother and I tag along. Why, shoot, here we are, 7, 8 years old. You think we're not going to go with him?
How'd you hunt it?
We'd just walk along and watch for him in the tree, and when he'd see one, why, he'd shoot things in.
So would you go down in the river bottom, or?
Well, it was where we lived, this Menard Creek or Bayou came through there, and it went through kind of a bottoms, and then the Bragg's Mountains started there, off up through the hills there, and then there was another little creek that ran right in front of the house that went off up through that run most of the year. It would run most of the year. In the spring, if we got a real dry year, it didn't run. But most of the year, it had a little water in it all the time, coming from springs up there. And we just go either up that or up along the edge of the farmland around, and we're in that way. And there was hickory trees, a lot of hickory trees in there. And there were squirrels in there just about any time he wanted them. There were squirrels in there.
Yeah, run up down the creek to get them? Or?
No, we just followed the farmland and run up and went around in the woods that way, around where he was at. And that was up where Dad cut all his firewood all the time. We always did. There was open land up in there and a lot of timber that was good for firewood, and that's where he cut firewood and split it and hauled it out of there up in there. That way he didn't have to go quite a ways off to get it and everything.
Were the squirrels large?
Oh, well, they'd weigh 1/2 pound, I guess, 3/4. They weren't very big. Usually take two of them to one or two, as I remember it, he'd usually take one home and for him, because he liked it fried, and then they'd take one and cook it up, and make dumplings out of it, boil it until the meat come off the bones, and then they can make dumplings out of it, put a little milk or something in it, I guess, and roll out biscuit dough real thin and drop it in there and make squirrel dumplings.
Did you like it?
I thought it was good eating. It'd still be good eating yet today if we had it.
Do you ever eat frog?
Eat frog? Oh, yeah. Sure, brother and I were pretty good frog hunters.
How'd you do that?
Oh, well, we were fishermen frog hunters. We were the wildest two kids in the country. What we didn't think of to do. But we'd take a cane pole or a willow pole, what we had for fishing, and try to swipe a piece of red cloth off of Mom and go up and down and find a bank where there was a lot of roots sticking out of it and down around the water line. And we'd go along and find these old big old bullfrogs that would get up on those limbs, you know, roots. And we'd let that fish hook down that way until the old frog would reach out and lap it in.
Because of the red cloth.
Yeah, he'd reach out and with his tongue and jerk it in his mouth, and then we'd jerk him. We had a frog. That's how we caught frogs. And we went fishing all the time. We was frog hunting one time there, and had been walking along, and boy, we was, I don't know, had three or four frogs apiece, and we're about ready to go in. And here come a couple of alligator gars. Alligator gars. It's a fish swimming up through the thing, and they must have been, probably weighed 20 pounds, but and it builds on maybe 15, 16 inches long. But when we seen them things, it kids' mind and things, but they looked like the longest things they'd ever seen. We run a mile and a half home, scared half to death. Something was after us going to get us. But looking back, knowing what an alligator gar fish is, that's the only thing it could have been. But, man, they looked like they was 50 foot long and 20 miles high after us when they come up the river. There we looked up, hear these two alligator gar swimming up that bayou.
Were they in any real danger?
No, they would just fish. No danger to anybody. It just... Just kids' imagination getting scared and running off. We got scared and run anyway.
Did you ever pole fish, get out in the creek and hit them with a pole?
No, I never did do any of that. But my brother was a fisherman, and Dad used to take what we called a trot line. And it was a nice big curve, and water was fairly deep and in a bend of the bayou there. And he'd throw the trot line out. We'd go down and throw a trot line out at night and bait it up and fix it up. And we've caught catfish that would go, they'd bend halfway around, put them in the number three wash tub, and they'd go across and bend halfway around that way. And as I remember it, those things would bring $2.50 to $5 in Muskogee on Saturday mornings. If you could catch one up and get it dressed right and take it to town, well, you could get a good price for it. That was a lot of money then. You could get over there, even if it only brought $1. Why, it was a added income that you got that way by catching them and doing it that way.
Did you hunt in the winter?
No, my dad never was much of a hunter. He didn't hunt any that way. He was more on work. His vocation was work. His vocation was work. And what's the other one? There's three of them. His hobby was work. And that was. But there's another name. It's advocation, vocation, and another one that says about like that. It means hobby.
And
yeah. Well, anyway. That's all he cared about. He didn't care about too much about going fishing or hunting or anything that way. He played ball with us kids and stuff like that, but he didn't like hound dogs. He didn't know way, and I always dreamed of wanting a hound dog, but that was a no-no, and so he never got one of them.
Did you do a lot of work as a child?
Oh, no more than necessary, but we all worked. Put it that way, we all worked. I remember one time, back when we had the mules over there, Dad raised a lot of produce and hauled it into a market in Muskogee there. That was the biggest, nearest town, which was 20 miles away. And
what kind of produce?
Garden stuff. He'd raise string beans, sweet potatoes, Irish potatoes, carrots, bell peppers, tomatoes, anything that way that people in town didn't have. And our garden, he called it garden truck, as I remember. But anyway, it was produce. And we were setting out sweet potato slips one time, and I guess I was 5, maybe 6 years old. Anyway, we'd go along there, and Dad, once in a while, instead of smoking, why, he'd chew day's work tobacco. And so, man, I had grown up and got hair on my chest then, and I wanted a big chaw of that day's work tobacco. And Dad said, "Now, you sure?" And I said, "Yep, I want a bite of that tobacco." So he cut me off a piece and gave it to me. And my brother said, "I got to have one, too." So he gave Bill a cut of that stuff. I guess I said made. I was making the holes for the sweet potatoes to be put in, and then watered. You go along, stick a hole every so often, put them there, you plant in it. And then you put water and come along and stuff put around so it'll grow. Put the dirt back around it so it'll grow. And I bet I didn't make a dozen holes till I lost everything I'd eat for 6 days. And sick? Oh God, I never was so sick in my life.
How about your brother?
Shoot, he can eat any. He can eat that stuff to this day. He never been sick on tobacco. And I smoke a cigar very once in a seldom, and everything else makes me sick. But not him. I'd forgot about this one. Along when we had that little store up there, we'd go through, and back then days where they'd have hard rock candy, and they had these drawers, you'd keep flour in one, and beans in another one, and something else in another one, and candy in this one.
Kind of like a bin?
Yeah, kind of like a bin. It was made that way. Door was square, like that desk over there, square door, and then there was a hinge back in there, and the thing was curved that way, and you'd tip it out, and it would hold stuff in it, and you'd push it back in the clothes. Anyway, there was hard candy and licorice or whatever was in that. And we would always sneak and go around through and swipe candy that way. Well, Mom had got tired of that. She had been going to what all she was going to do to us. We didn't sweep. Kids quit going through the store and swiping candy. This day we got caught. And she said, I'll fix you boys. You're going to get up there, and I'll get a little corn cob pipe and that cotton bowl twist, and I'm going to fill it up, and you got to smoke that pipe full of tobacco. That'll be good punishment for stealing candy. About the third puff, I was sick, and it took her 3 days to clean the store up. And that brother of mine, he finally ended up getting a whipping because he never did get sick. Tobacco just didn't. He was about 3 years old, I thought. Tobacco just never made Bill sick. But me, it got my good all the time. But we was getting him out, and I remember I was so sick, I didn't care whether I died.
Do you remember how you dressed?
Oh, I should have brought some pictures. I found them in there cleaning Mom's house the other day. Bib overalls, a blue shirt, work shirt, and button at the collar, and we looked wild. These pictures are when we were 4 and 6, and we looked wild. But in the summertime, we didn't have no shirt on, pants was usually cut off, and little as you could wear, and most of the time was a pair of bib overalls, about like I got on now, and a shirt. And hair all, Dad kept her hair cut up way high, that way just a little bit of hair up here on top. And that was so you didn't get them little bugs running around when you went to school.
Bugs?
Yeah, you'd get lice. And back them days, everybody would like going to the army, you kept your hair cut up short, and these boys with this long hair now, I don't see how they keep the lice down, but that was so that you didn't get lice. They keep your hair cut way short and just have a little bit up on top up here.
What would they do if you got it?
Oh, that scrubbing with sheep dip and everything else. Man, that's bad news, Harry, in our family. We'd have brought in lice from school. My mom would have died of mortification and it killed us to boot. That was the low of the low if you got lice coming in from school with lice. Now, I'm telling you, that was the low of the low. But
your school life?
I was a one, just the school was the one up at Menard. We had two rooms and had two teachers up there. But there was a whole bunch of Cherokee Indian kids that lived around there and went to school there. And I was the first year I was in school, and I was learning how to play dominoes so that my folks didn't fuss over playing dominoes. And as soon as I could play dominoes or a card game, they taught me, because that would be a three-handed game instead of a two-handed game. And back then, I don't know, with a coal oil lamp, you didn't have much time to do anything else. And I can remember playing dominoes when I was 4 years old, learning how to play dominoes and trying to count up the numbers, whether they made anything or not. And I assume later on that was so they didn't get in a fight over them playing, because they never did play unless I played. But in schools, there was this one school, we went to what they call the Valley School. That was in the second and third grades there, and part of the second and third grades there.
What year was that?
That would have been 1932, 33, 34, 35. Now, the old gal that taught's name was Pearl Triplett, and she's still alive and lives in Muskogee. And the last time I was there, I went to see her. She didn't remember me, but anyway, she put the fear of death in me in school. Because I run around with a little old boy, a kid named Paul Cooper, and he was the youngest man ever executed in the state of Oklahoma. And he was, when I was in the second and third grade, he was my number one dub. And so I don't know whether I was involved, but I didn't get to whipping anyway. He did. But anyway, he went up and tried to, I guess, take these pants off this little gal on the way home. Because he went one way home from school, and I went the other, and it happened on the way home from school. Anyway, she took him up in front of the class and whipped him until there was blood running down his leg, and he still wouldn't cry. And here he was, couldn't have been over 7 years old. And I remember, I thought, my God, that's the toughest kid I've ever seen. And that wasn't but very little bit after that to my folks took us out of school, boarded us in town, and we had to go to the town school.
Why was that?
Oh, too tough an element. She didn't want us associating with that tough an element. I guess that's what I've always heard anyway.
Were other kids like that?
Yeah, we were all pretty tough kids. They wasn't no... This one gal, they come in there and they moved up there, and the old Pearl would make her, the old teacher would make her stand out in the ante room where her father was a skunk hunter and killed and skinned skunks all the winter long. She stunk like skunks. The guy stung bad. She had to stand in the ante room. Then they'd pretty near run you out of the schoolhouse when you got hot.
What did your father hunt skunks?
That's the only way to make a living, I guess.
People would buy skunks?
Yeah, they'd buy skunk pelts or possum pelts or whatever there was. You know, he was a hunter. And he didn't live there long. He was one of those, he was like what we have here today in this country. And they so-called refer them as to Okies, that they may be from New York or they may be from Washington State now. But they're migrants, and they may only work a day or two here and a day or two there, and they get a dollar and they're gone. They had those kind of people back them days too. Only then they either walked or maybe had an old wagon or something they got around. But I've tried to remember that girl's name, but I can't remember her name.
Was she nice?
I don't remember. I was one of them times when boys didn't give a dang about gals. I don't remember.
Well, I had this friend of yours end up getting executed.
Well, he committed murder about 16 years old and was convicted of it. But that was 9-10 years after we came out here. But he was...
You weren't surprised.
No, he come from a tough family. His background was people that were known to be, if you say something, be sure and smile. Don't come up and say it with a frown, say it with a smile, because they were known to be tending their own business, and you be sure and tend to your business, or they'd get on to you real quick.
This is session 2, tape 1. Of an interview with Mr. Charles M. Newsom by Michael Neely for the California State College Bakersfield, California Odyssey Project at 25199 Road 164, Visalia, California, 93277, on May 12, 1981, at 9 a.m.
Well, let's start with... getting ready the things you did to get ready to come to California.
Well, they had to sell all the livestock. I mean, this fellow came to buy a bunch of fat hogs that we had, and I didn't talk plain, and I ran up and showing him the hogs. Mom and sent me out to show him the hogs in the pen there was built out of logs with a split log floor. Jumped up, and I said, oh, that's old Stick over there, and he thought I was saying sick. So he didn't buy the hogs until Dad had to go get him, bring him back, speak to him, show him that I didn't talk plain and all that stuff to get the man to buy them. And then Paul, we had a team of mares that we were going to sell on a harness and horses that way. And Dad always just yelled when we'd be out that way to us kids running around, like just say, oh, that old team of bulky mares, you know. Like any father will kid until he saw kids that way. And this fella come out from town, off from Muskogee, way over there somewhere to buy them. And we'd mom sent us down in the where they was running out down in the pasture down there, going along, and naturally as any guy will, he's asking us boys what kind of horses he was. And, oh, Dad just calls him a more bulky mares, and no way did he ever taste. He turned around, went back, no way would he buy them horses then. For that, us kids telling him, well, Dad just calls him a more bulky mares, you know. And so.
Where is your family living at that time?
And out on Bernard's Bayou, out east of Fort Gibson, Oklahoma, about 6-7 miles east of there. But those are some of the things that I remember real plain that happened when we were getting ready to come out here. And we come out, Dad had bought a 1931 Model A Ford truck, and it put bows up on it. And canvas over it, just like a covered wagon or like Joe's were when they came out here, only it was pretty well new and pretty well fixed up. And on the way out, the only thing I've talked to my mother and tried to remember where we stayed, because I knew I couldn't remember ever camping on the side of the road. And I would rent cabins along. It would be partly furnished. You had to furnish your own bed linens, and we'd go in and cook. And lunch, well, we always cook lunch, have lunch alongside the road or driving. And
what would you eat?
For lunch, you could buy a stick bologna like that, and that much for 10 or 15 cents, you could buy a whole stick of it and a loaf of bread for a nickel, and that's what usually would have that along the road, driving that way. We had brought a bunch of Irish potatoes and sweet potatoes along that we had from back there that we grew. And that night, they'd bake the sweet potatoes and have them cold during the day going that way. And there was an aunt and her daughter and son that came with us out here with my dad and mom and brother and I. And then another fellow, Cedro Taylor, came along to help do the driving.
What was his name?
Cedro Taylor. And I don't know how they spelled it. All I ever heard was just Cedro, and that's what they called him. So coming along, there was no way to stop us guys from the back. There'd be the four kids and my aunt always in the back, and maybe my mom would be in the back. And anyway, it would come time to go to the bathroom. This cousin, which was seven, she was seven, and she was most embarrassed. Funny, no way was she going. She was just at the age where she wasn't going to do nothing in front of no boys or anything that way, and have to go in the pot in that mango chamber pot and drive. The hell it was, I guess you'd never tell it, but they'd drive down the road, and first car they come through out the side of the truck, that when you dumped your chamber pot. And we got to when we got to the border of California,
go ahead.
They would take them, as at that time we had border searches, and especially Okies you had to take and declare everything, and they weed our sweet potatoes and our Irish potatoes, and they all that kind of stuff they took away from us there. Then we came on in, and I can going through the desert. We had worried about getting through the desert from, but we came down out of Oatman, Arizona, down to Blythe, and crossed there, not down Needles rather, and crossed the Needles to San Bernardino. And it was supposed to be all that desert across there. And they'd worried. I'd heard my dad and mom worried about that. We went off over that like nobody's business, and then they'd been scared of the grapevine coming down the grapevine into Bakersfield. Well, that was. But we had good equipment because they didn't have no trouble. But when we got to the first place we stopped where we was headed for was Woodville. And his uncle was supposed to have this house rented, had a house rented for us. Well, we got there. Where we found him was in a cotton tent camp up there, all bowed up with a bunch of other single men and everything. And the kids all jumped out of the back of the truck when we found him up there. First thing he lit in was these goat heads or puncture vines.
But you didn't have shoes on.
No, we did. I was barefooted naturally, and we lit and them things, and we had never seen one of them before. We didn't know what to try to get out of or get into. We just knew we was a bunch of stuck-up little Okies there with those feet, those puncture burrs in our feet. Man, they had dried. They already had frost, and they was plenty stickery too, boy. I can remember that. My little brother, he was bawling. He didn't know. All he could do was sit down. He'd sit down when he'd sit down. He was in that much worse shape setting down. But that was how we got out here.
Now, tell me, how many people were with you when you got here?
Well, there was there were four of us, my dad and mother and my brother and I, four in our family. And then my aunt, we brought my aunt and her two children. And the youngest one would have been, he was born in November of 32, so he would have been just coming three. And then my brother was, he was six. And I was 9, and this other girl, the cousin, was 7, coming on the way out here. And the two, her their mother, and my mom and dad, and this friend that rode along to help drive, Cedro Taylor. He was a cousin of my aunt's.
Do you remember how much money your parents had when they died?
Yeah, they had sold all their cattle and livestock, put everything in the bank, but it's $100. And they said, if we can't go to California and get a start and make it on $100, why, we'll wire back, get enough money to get back, and that's it. But $100, we can't make it out there and make it, get enough work and make it on $100, why, there's no way of spending any more.
And what month and year was it?
It was October of 1935. We got to Woodville on my dad's birthday, October 22nd.
Makes it easy to remember.
Yep.
Well, how did things go? when you got here?
Well, they were still picking, first picking cotton.
I mean, did you get a place to stay?
Oh, yeah. As soon as he got here, as I remember, it was a Saturday. In fact, I'm almost sure it was a Saturday because they went to Porterville. Dad found Don by Uncle John there. And that was the only time in my life I ever seen him when he wanted to take and flat whip him. And I guess he was really mad about him not having a house. But he didn't have a house anyway. So they rushed into Porterville to the lumber yard, and they bought a tent, enough stuff to make a floor for it, and wall, and a frame for it. They bought a, 12 by 14, whatever size tent it would have been. And me dad boxed it up, and that's where we stayed in all for probably a month. We lived in a tent 2 weeks, whatever it was, and then he had a house.
Where did you get the land for the tent?
Well, it was just down, at that time it was in between the two branches of the Tule River, right straight north of Woodville, about a mile and a half.
Was it on public property?
Oh, no. It was on property, this fellow that they were picking cotton for, George Bowles, had probably 800 acres of cotton around there, he had a camp there for the people to live in, and it was down in the willows and between the two creek beds there, and he furnished water. There happened to be a well or something around there somewhere where everybody could get water, and that's how he'd furnished. Back then, that each guy had a lot of cotton, have a camp somewhere, and it set up with where there was water and toilet facilities, I guess, that way, and they lived that way for the people to work for him that fall, pick cotton. And we went picking cotton for him, and my dad could pick 400 pounds a day, and mom could pick three, a little better than 300. And my brother and I, I was supposed to pick right at 100 pounds a day, which I could do pretty well at 8 years old, and he'd get 50, 75 pounds, and we lived off what I made. It was 90 cents a hundred, and we could live for 90 cents a day. And the rest of it, dad saved the money up because he was going to be in farming out here as soon as he could, and so. But when the cotton picking was over, ready to make another crop, but we didn't start till school till after New Year's. From October till after New Year's, they kept us out of school. And so he went to work for this George Bull at $50 a month then. That's on the 1st of January. And we started school then after New Year's at Tipton down there.
Your father got a permanent job?
Yeah, he had a permanent job. He's going to want to work for wages for 1 year to see how they farmed out here. Then he thought he had enough money back east in the bank. Well, he could get started. If he could find some land somewhere, he could get started farming, which he did. But we started school in Tipton down there, and I can't remember the teacher's name. I was in the third grade, and I'd been in the fourth grade back east, but come out here, my mom said, well, they're so much smarter in California and everything advanced in school, so you kids go to the school, and they put us back a grade, which I guess was the best thing, but they wasn't no smarter than we were back there. But anyway, I can't remember the teacher's name that we started there, but anyway, she was a crippled lady. And there's a couple of guys I know around Tulare here that remember and know her name, but I can't remember it. And anyway, the principal school was A.B. Stewart.
Stewart.
Yeah. He was the principal of the Tipton Elementary School at the time. And we went to school down there, and the first day we went, I had never went to school with a Mexican or Indian or colored man or nothing. Well, we went to school back there while they had their school and we had our school. And so went in the school there, and they signed this teacher, told me to go sit in this desk. And back then we didn't have these nice seat desks like our individuals. It was everything was in a row. And she assigned me a desk, and it was right behind the only colored kid in the class. And so I little Okie, smart ass Okie or something, and I never had went to school with them, so no way was I going to sit behind no colored kid. So I went to the back of the room where there was an open desk but no seat, and took what she gave me. And pretty soon she looks up and sees me back there and tells me, well, I thought I told you to sit over here. I didn't answer and didn't go over there either, so she got on to me a second time, and by then I was getting scared of what was going on for it, what had happened when I got home, and I told her, I said, teacher, I don't sit behind no nigger. So when recess time comes, naturally that's when that fight got started. And so that kid and I fought, the colored kid and I fought for that rest of that school year. Then he went somewhere else, moved and went to another school started that fall. Because we still there, and I started school back in Tipton in the fall. But we graduated from high school together and played football together in high school, and he's one of the best friends I ever had then. and he's already passed on now, but gone, but he was one of the best friends I ever had in life, the kid was. But that was where we come out from different areas, and these people out here look down on the Okies, but those Okies look down on some other people too at the time. But that was something. And then the next fall when we started school, we got some friends around the country, and we'd worked that some. Daddy worked irrigating, and us kids had helped him irrigate and do that. Whatever 9-year-old kid could work and help around that way, Dad doing.
Now, did you work when you came home from school?
Oh, yeah, we'd help him. We didn't go out and work for pay or anything, but if Dad was irrigating or whatever he was doing, why, if he was out working, why, there was an old broken-handled shovel some kind of kid could run and do, or carry pipe and the stuff like that. There was a kid that always could help his dad do things, but as far as working for pay, we never got paid for it. It was just helping Dad do make his job easier.
And your father was still working on
that? Yeah, he worked all that year, started in January and worked until crop was laid by at that. And for this George Bowles, which is he was a real nice old fellow. One of the best friends my dad ever had.
Well, what kind of house were you living in at this time?
Well, it was just a house that's no more down there. They've tore it down in the last, about 20 years ago. But it was, at the time, it was a fairly nice house. It was, roof didn't leak. And it was big enough that for a while that my uncle and his family lived in part of it, and we lived in part of it. And oh, there was a funny thing about this cousin, this Jimmy. He's was the youngest boy of this uncle at that time. They've had two more since, but Jimmy was 3 years old, and he didn't talk too plain. And he'd come around, and he had him a puppy. And as usual, when two brothers and two sister-in-laws live in pretty close proximity, they usually get to be a little fuss fighting somewhere. And my aunt was a little off. She was one of these kind of people that kind of got her nose out of joint easy anyway. And anyway, this Jimmy, my cousin, come around. Well, he wasn't supposed to come around to our part of the house, but he'd come around and shove his little puppy in the door, and he'd have to come in to get the puppy, and we'd be having, say, biscuits for supper. We'd have some kind of meat, potatoes and biscuits or gravy. Mom, back then we didn't buy bread. It was easier to make biscuits. And he'd come in, and he always called. His mother didn't make the best of gravy. My mom would make a lot better gravy than his mother. And he called biscuits and gravy Bo-Dayton.
Bo-Dayton.
He couldn't say biscuits and gravy. He'd just say Bo-Dayton. And he'd push the puppy in. And he could come in then to get his puppy in, and we'd always give him some Bo-Dayton. And, he's 48 years old, and we still call him that.
Call him Bo-Dayton?
Yeah. Nobody else does, but I and my brother still call him Bo-Dayton all the time. But he don't let nobody else call him that. He don't like his nickname that well. But he was it was fun. We had during the summer when we was helping Dad irrigate, we was playing in this water. The well water came around. There was sandy ground. The little ditch had washed out real wide, And we was sitting there playing in the water because it was hot in the summer and the way to cool off. And my brother and his wife wears a wedding ring. He found a gold band wedding ring that was almost a half inch wide. And when he got married then, he had that ring cut in two. And part of it fixed up as an engagement ring, and the other one is a wedding ring, and that's what he had it made up in for his wife's wedding ring.
He found it down there?
Yeah, he found it. He found it in the ditch just playing there. And like I say, it was a fairly small ring, but it must have been six and a half or seven. It was because it was real small, because he had to have it stretched a little bit for his wife to wear it. But when he got married, he had it fixed into an engagement and wedding ring for her.
Did you have trouble when you went into the school with kids looking down on you?
Oh, God, yes. They thought us Okies were, there was nothing lower than the Okies. And as we'd tell them, we wasn't Okies, we were Oklahomians, and they'd better start fighting right then. It was a matter of, not life or death, but where we came, where we was at, came back, we thought we were somebody. We weren't no, what the real Okie was called came from all states, and California as well. It was the lower class people, just like today. You call somebody an Okie today, you're not necessarily referring to any state or anything. You're referring to a class of people. And it was, that at that time, they would just lumped us all together. But
you didn't like to be lumped. Huh?
We didn't like the lumping part, and we tried to stop that part. But I don't know whether to tell it, but there was a favorite saying around back then, and that the Okies come to California for two things, and one of them was to cut down sunflowers and kill SOBs, and the sunflowers were disappearing, but the SOBs were multiplying. And when they called you an Okie, that was usually a stock answer. And then you either had to prove that you could do it, and as the Missourians always said, it was show me time, and they wanted to be showed everything. Well, the Okie was the one that could show them. And so that's why there was a lot of little tough Okie kids running around schools, because they had to be tough, because they really did try to look down on you and tried to treat you that way, even though...
Was there any reason for that? I mean, did...
Well, as I said, they were a certain class of people come from all states that even we looked down on. And we didn't like to be looked down on just because we had to be from some segment of the area. But I guess the people here that came out, they all came from somewhere else before us, and they felt challenged or something. I think that was, looking back, I think it was that more than anything else. Because the people that came from Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Kansas, Louisiana, Tennessee, or wherever it was out, there were some New Mexico people came in here. Those people were willing to work. And they'd worked long, hard hours trying to get ahead. And some of the people out here had been raised on a silver spoon, and there had been generations that their parents or grandparents had came and got land, and these people had learned how to live on a silver spoon, and they didn't know how to get out there and compete with these people. I'm quite sure, and thinking back, that was it. And in our neighborhood here, I can look around the community of the people that are here when we came here 45 years ago or 47 years ago, that... They were the big shots. Well, today they're done, lost all their property, and they couldn't hang on to it, and it's changed and gone somewhere else, and it must be quite degrading to them, I think, looking back over it that way, because, and that's the only reason I can see. But
it's a very interesting idea.
I think they really felt challenged, because it's like all civilizations in life, and that's my own philosophy of life. That after a while you live such a soft life that somebody that's, you get used to a soft, easy life, and here comes somebody that's had a tough whack at it. Well, that old boy, that tough whacker at it, he's a lot tougher than you are, and you better get with it, or he'll whack you down and take over, and you'll be out, and he'll be in. And I think that's what it was. They were definitely had got soft, and these little guys were tough, and they wanted something, and they were willing to give up anything to get it. A lot of them.
You and your family certainly did well.
Well, we haven't done as well as a lot of the others. I know a lot of people, and take the Maddoxes from Riverdale. They came out here a little later than we did, and they didn't have anything, and my gosh, they own half the country in Riverdale, over around Riverdale, California. You know, and it just, that some of those guys from back there, well, they was willing to give it. You take down the lake bed of Tulare lake bed farming. Most of those guys that's got anything down there came from somewhere else. They're not native here. They came, when the cotton came, well, they came from somewhere else.
And they got it by hard work.
They were willing to work for it, and they accumulated and got it. And there's people all over this valley, southern San Joaquin Valley, that they're well-to-do, well-off. They're well-respected people in the neighborhoods today that came from back there, and they went through this same thing. And some of them rode the rods on freight cars coming out here, any way to get here, you know. But when they got here, they were willing to work, and it was a land of opportunity. Hmm. And so...
How did things go for you then?
Well, when we was going to school, and I was going to tell you about little kids getting let off, there was these neighbors there, and that name's Killingsworth. They worked for a fellow named Davis, and when we and Dad was working for George Bowles, and this boy named Melvin Killingsworth, and I guess I was in the fourth grade that year. Next year I'd be in the fourth grade. Well, he taught my brother and I, and we had to walk about a mile to catch a bus to ride to school. And so he talked us in the next fall. We hadn't been going to school too long, and he was in the seventh or eighth grade. Anyway, there was a couple of girls. One girl was in my grade, and another one younger, and that. But anyway, this Melvin, he coerced us into we was going to walk to school this day. And it was long. They were picking cotton. Must have been in October, late September sometime. Anyway, we was picking cotton already. And my mom was working, weighing cotton for George Bowles, and Dad was doing something. He was spotting trailers or helping pull trailers to Jen. He was working for the month yet. And he was getting ready to quit because he could make so much more money picking cotton than he could by working for the month. Anyway, why? We ditched school. We was going to walk to school, not ride that bus. And so by the time we got to school, why, it was almost dead noon. But we got there. Must have got there at 10:30, 11, somewhere around 11, one way or the other. But anyway, we got there, and so the first place where they took us in was old man, this Mr. A.B. Stewart's place. And we took in there, and so, man, he's getting ready to go and give us a licking for ditching school. And so he took Melvin in. I guess he whipped Melvin so hard that time he got to us, well, I felt sorry for us anyway, because my brother and I didn't get a licking out of it anyway. But anyway, the attendance officer, though, had done been to the cotton field out where we lived looking for us while we wasn't in school. And when we got home that night, I'd a lot rather got the whipping at school than when I got at home. But we didn't ditch school no more. That was for sure. At least Melvin didn't told us off to go off ditch school no more. My brother and I. That was for sure.
How'd your dad whip you?
Well, I don't remember, but he had a razor strap, and I guarantee you, when he got through with something like that, when he told you not to ditch school, he got through with you knew you wasn't going to ditch school no more. It may not have been all that hard as at the time, but as I'm remembering back, well, he knew how to take care of it. You didn't ditch school no more. You got the message, and you got it fast. But we grew up, and we had a lot of fun. Like one time, there was a real good friend of my mom. She had got acquainted with these people named Hudson. And he was a boy that was my age, and every time he'd come over, well, he'd swipe our marbles, my brother and my marbles. When he went home, well, we would have no marbles. So he'd take the marbles home. We was always told that when you had guests, well, you treated them nice and all this stuff, you know. You tried to, wasn't supposed to accuse them of stealing your marbles or anything. And so every time Dewey would go home, we'd try to complain, well, Mommy, he took half of our marbles. And so she says one time, says, well, the next time he does it, well, I said, you take him, don't let him do it, well, we'll buy you a Gene Autry holster and gun. So the next time it happens, I wanted that Gene Autry gun bad. So I piled in and whipped his button, didn't let him steal the marbles. And thank God I didn't go in the house and tell Mama, I want my gun and holster. I whipped him, even right in front of his mother and dad. At least I said something not to do that. Because he was scared to death I was going to do it anyway. Well, he went in crying. Well, they finally went in and told him what it was. Well, I don't know what happened to Dewey anyway, but he never did steal no more of our marbles anymore anyway. And I never did get my Gene Autry gun and holster either. I've griped about that for 40-some years, but 45 years, but I never did get that anyway. That's neither here nor there. Well, yeah. But we had a lot of fun growing up. It was, I know a lot of people will tell you sad stories about it and how tough it was. I guess it was, but we worked our fannies, worked all the time, and the next year, in 1937, Dad rented the 40 acres over by Visalia to farm and bought a tractor. And then,
what year was this now?
1937. He worked for wages in 36 for Boy Bowles in 37 when he rented this place over by Visalia. And he bought a little CC case tractor and the tools to do it with. It was not a rubber tire, it had steel gougers on the wheels. And somehow or other, it was late. And I guess there was somebody had financed a crop piece of land or something for the same gin or something off to the southwest of Tulare out there. It was about 12 miles from where this 40 acres was. And anyway, Dad got the hold of that kind of late in the spring. It was awful late to get in cotton in. And so he ended up with farming about 160 acres that year. But that 40 acres where he lived, my brother and I, after the first cotton chopping, we kept all the weeds hoed out of it after school. And he would have been, I was 37. I would have been 11. I would have been 10, coming 11. And he was 8 in the spring. And we irrigated the 40 acres of cotton and kept the weeds out of it and still had time to get in all kind of mischief. And still go and help. Sometimes one of us could go and help down at the other place, because it was real unlevel, and took his dad and one or two men to interrogate the dang thing. It was so hard work down there. But he went on and made it, and then when we got at the end of that crop year, I guess Dad, he had paid for his tractor, paid for all the equipment, got Mom a radio, one of those great big console radios that was in effect at that time. My God, as I remember, that thing was 3.5 foot wide looking at it and 4 foot tall. It was a big fancy piece of furniture them days. Got that for her. Now, I don't remember what it cost, but he got my brother and I each a bicycle. And had, I think, if I remember him saying right, about $37 or $40 left out of the crop. Worked all that year and paid for a tractor and whatever equipment he had to go with it, a disc and section arrows or whatever he had to have to go with it, and the two bicycles and a radio. That's what we ended up with out of it. Climbing a crop and cotton crop in 1937.
This is session one, tape two of an interview with Charles M. Newsom for the California State College Bakersfield California Odyssey Project by Michael Neely at 25199 Road 164, Visalia, California 93277 on March 23, 1981 at 2 p.m.
What was this Camp Gruber you were talking about?
Well, it was an Army base that was developed there for World War II, and that's why I think all of our relatives, none of them ever came out here, because most of our relatives on my mother's side all worked out there sometime or other. And nowadays they've built it up, and they've opened it up in there. Part of it is a tin killer, and they've built a tin killer reservoir. And they built a dam in there, and they took part of it for that. And it's a big recreation area. It's in there. But Camp Gruber, part of it is still there, and it's leased to Texas cattlemen that come in there, and then they use the National Guard uses it. But when they first opened that, right around the start of World War II, well, I think that's why a lot of our relatives never came out here. That's why we were probably the only ones that ever came out here.
Before we get into your family leaving and coming out here, do you remember any of the illnesses that people had back then?
Oh, well, yeah. My dad had acute attack of appendicitis and liked to die and had to be rushed into the hospital and there. And then I guess his appendix had ruptured and he had peritonitis. And anyway, he was sick and gone for a long time in the hospital. And I don't know how much it cost, but it set us way back anyway. And he had that. And then one time it was flooding. And I guess it was in the spring of the year. Anyway, well, he had a great habit of going around taking little cans. And all can 2 or 3 inches in diameter and 3 or 4 inches long. He had nailed it up on post, and they had a lot of what we call wrens, little birds back there, and wrens, and these wrens like to nest in these cans. And he had put one up, and this next spring while he was looking, he'd put a clevis in it too that fall. Yeah, a clevis, a thing to hook up the horses to, tool to work with. And he reached up to get it, and a yellow jacket or a wasp came storming out and stung him in the throat. And paralyzed his throat, and he liked to strangle to death. And they sent me off on the horse up. We didn't have no telephone, actually. And they sent me on a horse around about, nearest phone was about 5 miles. And I had to go up the road about 1.5 miles and then turn left and go north, round by over what they called the Waterfield Ranch. And my uncle, stepbrother, my dad, lived there, and went to his house. Then we had to go across and swim the river, swim the thing on horseback to get across up there, and I swam this little horse across and got across over there, and that was the narrowest place in it, and got on the phone, and the old doctor came back, and by the time the doctor got back, well, it went down quite a bit where we didn't have to swim going back to flash flood or whatever it was. Anyway, well, if it would have been speed getting there, I guess Dad had died. But anyway, he got back there, and the doctor got there before he died and gave him something to counteract that sting in his throat. Oh, we had chicken pox, and everybody got the 7-year itch, I guess, in the winter. At least we did one winter. And like
what's that?
I don't know. It's you get the itch in the winter, and it's a disease of wearing heavy clothing, trying to keep warm, I guess. Anyway, well, Mom's favorite treatment for the itch was when you go out and you dig a poke root, a vegetable. It's a poke root grows wild, and it's a kind of a shrubbery or centenary or shrubbery or something that way, and anyway, you dig these roots up from the plant, and you kind of beat them up and put them in a pot, and you're boil them, and then heat up some water and dump that, oh, probably between a quart and a half of this down in this tub of soapy water she's got ready. And she souses you down to number three wash tub and gets you wet real quick and scrubs you all over. And that usually will kill the 7-year itch, because by the time that did it on me, I remember very plainly. It was snowing outside, 4 or 5 inches of snow, icicles 2-foot long hanging off the eaves, and I went out and rolled in the snow trying to cool off. I've never been that hot in my life since, as that poke root sour oil, poke root got me in that bath.
It was like a liniment or a...
You know, see, the itch would have you a little raw space, getting like a galled or something in that way, or a strawberry or something. And she took that and bathed you around your privates, under your neck here, in the back of your hair, where it would be at, under your arms. Nothing burned like that.
Did it cure it?
Dang whistling, it cured it. That was the end of that. But that was from playing with the wrong kids at school. From then on, Maud went to school and found out, and we had orders of which kids to play with at school.
Oh, you caught it from someone?
Caught it to catch it from the other kids, and it was not being too clean, basically, what it was caused from. So when she go to school, they go to school and find out which kids it was. Well, they know then you didn't play with them kids. But when we was going to this school here, though, where Pearl Triplett taught, when I was in the third grade, out there, I had a cousin, Patricia Patsy, who lives in Bakersfield now. She was in the second grade, and my brother was in the first grade. And they wouldn't come. Her dad and her mother always more or less lived with the Taylors, her mother was a tailor, and they lived around there in bad times with her grandfather Tom Taylor. But anyway, when her and Bill wouldn't come into the classroom.
Yeah, Taylor's a name.
It's a name. It's a family name. It's a family that my uncle married into. But anyway, well, this cousin and my brother had a sty going over the fence, and that's stair steps to go build up to get over the fence without crawling over it. And they was playing on this sty, and they was not going in the class. I bet they got their old Pearl must have whipped them 3 or 4 times that day, because they was not going in school. Every time she'd get them equipped and into class, they got out to recess while they had back on the other side of that sty, and they wouldn't come back in. And when Bill got home that night, Mom gave him to understand that he better get to school the next day, and that was the end of that nonsense. But I'd try to get him to come on in. I was always one that never did want my whippings in school, because Dad always said, whatever you get in school, you get this twice that at home. And I kind of halfway believed him, and so I would always try to get him not to do those things.
Did you remember anyone dying? Oh,
let's see, I never thought about that one even. No, I don't remember. Well, we had to be funerals we went to, but I don't, not necessarily. Yeah, we went to Shipley's funeral, some old folks there that lived there.
What was it like?
About like today, it was just out in the open. They had the funeral at the graveyard. There was no, we didn't have it at church or nothing, as I remember it. And cemetery was, they call it the Citizen Cemetery. It's about 2 miles east of Fort Gibson out there on the hill where my mother's, all her folks are buried, and some of mine too on my dad's side there.
Was there a lot of grief?
Oh, no more than today. I don't think there was as much. Certain people carried on then, certain people carry on today. There's some people that don't show their grief and emotionally that way, and then there's some that does. And the same ones that go to church and get all emotional in church are the ones that get all excited at a funeral, as I remember. I remember we'd go to church in town that way, and wouldn't have it in the church building. It'd be out in a under an arbor or something, open air thing that way, and those people that got all excited in church would get all excited at a funeral or a 4th of July picnic or anything else. But the funniest thing, about before we want to leave this back there, and you've got to get this in. When we lived on this creek down there, this was in 33, 34, and part of 35. Why, the colored people out of Muskogee, and there was a big group of colored people lived in, in Muskogee. Well, they'd come out there and have picnics, church picnics, 4th of July picnics, anything you could think of where they had a picnic out there. Where they got the food, the money, I don't know. But anyway, and it was quite an excursion out there. They would have to rode the railroad over to Fort Gibson and then hiked out that way. And there maybe had wagons or something. They had wagons, a bunch of them did. But anyway, well, they'd come out there and have these picnics and usually have a baptizing or church service or something involved along with the picnic. But when we, my brother and I, we lived probably, oh, just under a half a mile from where this creek was and where they'd do this. And it was a big island, probably an acre and a half island in the center of the bayou. And we'd take our cows down there and graze it down over 2 or 3 weeks while the grass would get up big enough. You could go down and get a day and a half grazing with 40, 50 head of cows off that thing because it'd be, oh, it's beautiful grass. And but we'd sneak off and go down to these picnics. I was our own Sunday or whenever they had a picnic and a baptism. While Bill and I, we'd somehow we'd sneak off and go down there, and our folks had raised heck with us about that. They'd raise holy dead, yet we wouldn't go to school with a colored. We didn't, nobody went to school with a colored person even then. They had their own school.
Well, what did you do when you went
down? Oh, go down and eat, man. They had the best.
Did they accept you?
Oh, man, did they accept you? They'd come in there, and when my folks had come to get us, why, I can remember that, because most lot of them we knew. And that one old granny there, I don't remember her name, but anyway, she'd get up there. She'd say, "Now, Miss Joe," said, "you know we're not going to mistreat this boy." Said, "We're just trying out our good cooking on them." Man, we'd have ice cream, chocolate cake, or fried chicken. It didn't matter. Whatever they, one of them thought that they had cooked that was the best in the picnic area, that's what they put us up on a table. We were set up on a table and a chair like we were the king and queen and the kings of the Siam up there. They really treated us royally.
Did you play with their children?
Yeah, we played with their children at home, but we didn't do it when we went anywhere else. That was a no-no when you there seemed to be, I don't know. And we had a colored man, that an old colored man named Preacher Noble that lived with us. He lived in a lean-to in the back of the house there. And stayed there most of the summer all the time when Dad would be gone running a harvester because have us feeding the hogs and heavy work there. Why, Noble did it.
How old was he?
He was probably in his 70s or older.
Was he a good man?
Yeah, he was a good man. He was a preacher, and his favorite saying was, "Now, don't," he'd get up and he'd start a sermon out, he'd say, "Now, folks, don't do as Noble do. Do as Noble tell you to do. Because Noble goes into dark places and does damnable deeds." That's the way he'd start out 99% of his sermon. But he was a good old man. But we would be ashamed of what we did. We missed Bill, and my brother and I mistreated that poor old fellow or something fierce. If a 6-year-old and an 8-year-old can mistreat an old man that way. My uncle Jim, he'd brought out this old Dodge, I guess it would be a Magneto or something. Anyway, you could take that thing, it had a couple of wire, had a wire or two off it, and you could take and crank that thing like that with your hand. Man, it would just flat lay out the juice out there, and it would really shock you. And when my mother, when this time, why, Mom would went off looking for peaches, went back away, rode the horse way back off somewhere back over in the mountain, somewhere where this fellow raised peaches over there, to get peaches to can. And when she'd go do that, well, she'd leave Noble in charge of us boys and stuff around the house. And what we couldn't think of to aggravate and do to poor old Preacher Noble, that wasn't dreamed up. And anyway, well, Bill, we sneaked in and had this thing, and we stuck it through the crack chink where the chinking was out of the, between the logs in the house. And he snuck up that way, and he'd take that damn wires and put that old man's feet, and I'd crank that thing and shock him beyond all. Then when he'd get up and he'd go and whip Bill, well, I'd grab a pitchfork and aid him. Wasn't nobody going to touch my brother, especially no nigger man. And then that was a bad thing about it. He was such a good old fellow, and he'd do anything for us. And we just flat mistreated him, and that was all there was to it. We shouldn't have done it, but we was kids, and we didn't know no better.
Why did he stay with you?
Well, he didn't have no other place to live. And they folks fed him, and they'd feed him the year round, and he worked there and give him a little money. And when we came to California, I can remember that old man crying and begging, wanting to come. But
did he eat in the house with
him? No, he ate in the same under the same roof, but he ate out in this lean-to out there. We had a there was an enclosed right off the kitchen was an enclosed part there, and that's where he slept. And he had his table out there, and when we'd sit down to eat, well, Mom would dish up his plate first, a big plate full of food, take it out to him, and then we'd come back and start eating. And about the time we'd get, oh, half done or a little something, why, she'd get up and go out and ask Noble if he wanted something else. And if there was anything else wanted, why, he handed her plate and came in, and she'd dish it up, and he'd go back and eat it that way. And stuff. And so that, I remember that, but he never ate at the table with us. Never a time.
Did he teach your boy?
No, he, not that I, except how we just practiced meanness on him. But he read the Bible a lot, and we'd take and run him off on this when she went after his peaches after we'd shocked him. We took a pitchfork and we'd run him off up the road probably a quarter of a mile or better. And Mom came in and found him up there. And she said, Noble, what are you doing off up here away from the house? And Noble said, Miss Newsom, them damnable boys done runs me off. And so Mom had lied into him about letting two little boys run him off. And he'd say, now, Miss Newsom, you know, them little boys, what they can't think of, they will really think it up next time. I guess we must have been characters. But another thing happened, I'll tell you a funny thing. These big old calves we'd keep in to make these cows come in. Well, one time my dad was talking to my mom's old boyfriend before he married her. Married my mother and dad got married. Well, old Louis Binge was her number one boyfriend.
Louis Binge?
Yeah, Louis Binge. And he never had gotten married. And I was, I guess, 8 years old, something like that. Anyway, well, Bill and Louis came up, and he always rode a stud horse for some, a stallion for some reason. Why, I don't know, but he did. And him and Dad was sitting talking under some trees outside of this wire corral we had to keep these big old calves in. And the fence was probably, there was a barbed wire probably 15 inches off the ground around it, tacked around. Then there was hog wire up there, and then three or four strands of barbed wire on top of that. And me, I was the number one cowboy. I thought I was a real cowboy. And every time I went anywhere, I had a rope. And so my brother, he always had a lid. He's a truck driver today, and he was practicing being a truck driver when he was 5 years old. And everywhere he'd go, he'd have a lid off of a lard bucket, and running around playing like he's a truck driver.
Like a steering wheel.
Yeah. And he was sitting in this number three wash tub that we watered these calves in there, and he was driving the truck. So I sneaked over and tied my rope into the bale on that thing. And this old big yearling come walking by, calf come walking by, and wham, I roped that thing and scared it. And there are the racers on that old calf that hadn't been roped, and he was scared. And around that pen he'd go, and there was rocks in it probably from this big up to about like that. And that old tub would hit one of them rocks and go, drew off this way and all that. And that old calf would turn, and it'd go under the fence and zip out. And about the second time, when it got around good, I looked up, and here come my dad off over there. From a flat standing jump, he went over the top of the fence over where he was at, and when he went over it, I went under it on the other side of the head, screaming for my Joe to the house. Because my mother never called her Mom until we come to California. It was always my Joe. But I was screaming my Joe as loud as I could to get away from there, because I knew he was going to tear me up for tying that big old calf to that tub.
Did he get you?
No. But anyway, that old calf run that tub around and around there, and my brother had the best ride. And as he remembers, he said, I never had so much fun in my life, but Dad sure stopped it. But anyway, we did that. And when Dad finally got the house, he got the calf stopped and untied, and he come to the house and looking for me, and he's going to clean the house on me. And old Louie came around and up the county road over by the gate out there, come in, and he told Dad, now hold. Said, that was kind of funny. You don't need to whip that boy. Said, hey, you got enough fury into him running screaming across there yelling for his my Joe. Said, he was scared enough. You don't need to whip him no more. And I was over. Mom had came out the house then, and I was standing there. I was scared to death he's going to get a hold of me anyway. But we did a lot of things and had a lot of fun that way.
Do you remember any kind of problems you had with the livestock?
This big mare was. She was bred, and another horse kicked her in the belly and killed a colt in her. And the regular veterinarian came dead, called the veterinarian out, and they couldn't deliver the colt. And as I remember, half the country was there for some reason. I don't know. I guess this old mare must have been a pretty valuable horse. Anyway, there was people all over there, and my mom would let me and my brother go down where they had that. And there was a little colored man there that was called Buster Van. Yeah, that was his name, Buster Van. And he was probably 25 years old, something like that. And he was, I guess he went around to this veterinarian some, but the veterinarian, as I remember, drank a little bit. But anyway, Buster went and took care of the colored people's stock and if they were sick or something and that. And anyway, well, this veterinarian went in there and he cut the front legs off the colt, clear up to the shoulders. And it was an excessively large colt, and then I guess it had been dead long enough to swollen up in the mare quite a bit. But anyway, they couldn't get it out, and instead of doing a cesarean, nowadays my veterinarian would have done a cesarean on one of our horses or cows. And they just said, well, the mare's going to die, I can't do nothing about it. And he just packed up his duds and got in his buggy or car or whatever he had, and he went to town. And old Buster said, well, they'd had her tied up over a tree limb with block and line trying to pull it and everything. Old Buster was standing there, and he said, well, Hobart, he says, well, I've heard the story. He said, if you don't care, he says, let me give a whirl at that. I said, I think maybe I can get that colt if you'll let me try. And the old mare was so give out and wore out and near down. She was down, couldn't get up no more. And so he went to pulling and working, and shoot, he had to kill it out in 30 minutes, where that veterinarian had been working for 24 hours messing the job up. But anyway, while old Buster took a... He took a single tree clip, or a hook off the end of a single tree, and hooked on his hand some way, and he went in and got a hold of the head of it.
What's a single tree?
Single tree is where you hitch one horse up with, and then the double tree to pull and work a team. That way it's a piece of wood or whatever you want to make it out of, or metal, that you hitch a horse up to pull things with. And then they have metal clips on the end of them to hook the trace chains on. Yeah, he just pulled it off that, and he went in and hooked it in some way, and he worked it around, from what I've been told since. He got it straightened out, and it wasn't 30 minutes, and he had to cold out. And the mare went on, and when Dad sold her to this, he sold her to a cousin's husband of ours, and I guess she raised 10 or 12 mules. Afterwards, he took her home, and he matched her up with a big gray Perchin stud he had. And he raised horse colts out of her. But the other mare wouldn't breed to a horse. She always bred to a mule.
What was that?
I don't know. The bay mare we had, she never did have a horse colt. She always had it when you breed her to a stallion, she'd never have a colt. Breed her to a jack, and she'd have a colt, a mule colt all the time.
You bred them to a jackass and make a mule?
Mm-hmm. I don't know why that was. Don't ask me. It's just one of them stupid things. But the team, where I can remember... This team, we'd go down, and Dad was hauling some kind of feed stuff. He'd raise this feed across over another field somewhere, and you had to come down and go down into a gully, real steep gully, and then right straight up. It was right like that. And go down there, and when we'd go to come up out of that thing, well, this one he called Maud, why, she had hit that blasted thing when she'd come up and start to go up that pull of wagon up out of there. She'd lunge into it and hit it, and he either broke a single tree or a double tree time every time he went after a load of grain. A load of maize over there. He was cutting high gear and bringing it in and making feed for winter out of it.
High gear?
Yeah, that's a milo, or we call it milo today, but they called it high gear then. It grew about 8-10 foot tall and would have a head on the top of it with grain in it. And they hauled it and cut it green. They hauled it in, stacked it in the barn, and they had used it for head. They used it for feed for cattle in the winter. But anyway, old Maud, every time she'd done out and start out, he was constantly making single trees and double trees. That mare hitting that thing all the time.
What kind of diseases did the animals get?
Well, I know we had hog cholera, I know, and I guess when that hit, you had that wiped out. But anything else, I don't remember.
Hog cholera?
Yeah, I don't remember anything else.
What about insect pests in the crop?
I don't know. They had boll weevil, I know, but I don't remember spraying anything. Oh, I know. I remember one time we just did something that was funny. Wasn't funny, but it was strange. But dusting for potatoes. I had this potato bug somehow got in when he was growing our potato crop or something. And to dust these potatoes, Dad took a pole and rigged it up across the top of the saddle. And he went and got this arsenic. And he put arsenic in little bitty Mom took flour sacks and sewed these little sacks up, probably hold 5 pounds, maybe 10 pounds in each one. And he took a string down, and right over each row, he made this pole long enough to fit over 4 rows. And he tied the strings down so that this little bag would hang right over the row of potatoes. And he'd take this horse and trot it down through the field.
You mean he hung the string so yeah. he could tell that the bag
uh-huh.
was over the,
over the rows. And then he'd take the horse and let her trot and ride on it and balance this pole across there. And it'd trotting down through the field, it would shake those bags and shake that arsenic out. And he dusted the potato crop that went saved. I can remember that. Well, it worked. That was I remember that, and it worked. He said he got them bugs killed off the potatoes anyway that way. But I don't remember him doing anything else in line of spraying or anything that way.
Well, what was it like just before you came to California?
Well, that was we lived there on this place on this creek there, and that was the summer before we came out here. Why, I know of 3 times we went down and went picnicking with our colored folks. And
but do you remember your parents making the decision?
No, I don't remember them talking. All I know when they talked decisions, even up till we were grown, they made up and then they told. Then us kids was told later.
What'd they tell you?
Well, they just as I remember, why, Dad, we came in from school one day and here was this. Model A truck parked there, and it had a bed on it. It had I don't know how long a bed on it, but anyway, probably 10-foot bed on it, and it had canvas over it and arches on it, like a covered wagon over it. And come in, and I remember my brother and I, and my mom was crying and going on and stuff. And
when was this exactly?
That would have been October, September of 35, and. So we said, well, what's wrong? And she said, well, we're going to sell out and move to California. But, and diseases, you was asking diseases. Well, when Roosevelt came in as president, a year or so later, we killed off hogs and cattle. Well, I can remember riding with my dad going to one of those big dugout things. They had cats or bulldozers or something. They dug these great huge pits.
Why did they do that?
And they would take your cattle and pay you so much a head and shoot them and bury them.
Was it a fair price?
I don't know what the fair price is. It's probably better than nothing. They had too many of them anyway, and it's better than nothing. And at least it got some money into people's hands.
They didn't sell them for food?
No. They'd take and cover them with quicklime and just bury them.
Why wouldn't they let people eat
well,
them?
Well, don't ask me. That was one of Roosevelt's programs. They buried hogs.
Couldn't people have eaten them?
Well, I guess they could have, but this is one of the things they did. They buried hogs, and they buried... cattle that way, killed them and quick-lined them and buried them that way and gave the farmer so much. I think back, well, I don't know why they fed all these food lines, why in the world they did that, but they did. I remember riding over there. It was on Phil Hunter's place where they had it bulldozed out, and that was about 10 miles from where we live.
You know, bulldozed, that means they had a tractor.
Yeah, they had a tractor of some kind. They had this huge pit there, and they'd drive the cattle down in it. And our guy'd stand up on the side with a gun and shoot them. Then they'd go down and pour quicklime all over them and cover everyone when they got all through that day. Then they'd cover them all over with dirt. But we went over there. The guy was supposed to have been there at 9 o'clock to went to kill them. And Dad sat around there, and I did most of keeping the cows in a group there, our bunch. And he stood around and talked and long, I don't know, 3:30, somewhere along there. Anyway, it was made it dark. Time we drove our cow and got home, it was dark. He come over and he says, well, I'm going to go home and take my chances. If they're worth nothing today, why, 6 months ain't not going to be worth nothing. They'd be worth a whole bunch. And this, 6 months later, he sold them for $55 a head.
And how much were they paying?
They were probably paying $5, $10, something like that, but it was nothing.
Must have been hard on those people that raised all those cattle to see them just thrown away.
Yeah, was I can remember. I didn't want to see them butchered that way. Just as a kid, you know, like some of them things while we'd raised, and because we always anything that had little bitty short teeth, that was my job from the time I was old enough to walk around the creel with that. I had little bitty hands, and I had to milk anything that had little short teeth on the cows. That was mine to milk, and because it's hard to get a hold of. If I had a kid today, I'd make them milk them too. I wouldn't milk them. But
what I mean, it's like what you're saying, that even if the person needed money, it was probably hard for him to see.
Oh,
waste,
yeah, sure.
Because that was waste.
Yeah, it was pure waste, but they killed a lot of hogs and a lot of cattle that way. But he came home and sold his. When we came out here, he sold every cow he had for $55 a head. And that was pretty good money that way. But That about covers as much as I can remember from back there. Oh, and we'd have hog killings going, and Dad was always the number one butcher in the country. If they was going to have a hog killing, he had to go and do the shooting, and he did the butchering and all that kind of stuff. And I've always wondered why, after we come out here, why it's a shame that we didn't do more of that and pass it on where we can learn. I know how a little bit of it, but I don't know how to go and cut a hog up and take in salt and fix a shoulder for curing or a ham for curing. I don't know how to do it. And he did. He was a cracker jacket doing that kind of work.
Sounds like quite a guy.
And everything, so. But anyway, that's what he did. That's when the hog kiln come up over Granny's or over that place over there or that place, why, they always called Noel Hobart Newsom to come and help. And that way.
So we're up to about the time you came.
Yeah. Well, that's when the corn floated down the river and the Model A truck sitting in the yard ready to come to California.
Did your father have to borrow the money then for the next year?
Yeah, well, they was, gins would finance you, you know, and I don't remember. I think cotton was 7-8 cents a 100 pounds, and on the next year, I knew it was a 12. We got up to 12 cents a pound. But anyway, we farmed out, and in the next year, 38, why, we moved over here about a mile and a half from where I live now. And there was a 40 acres at the end of Prosperity Avenue, and then 105 acres down the road, just almost a mile and on the opposite side of the road. And it was owned by Ed Holbrook, who was a gin manager for cotton, for Anderson Clayton Cotton Gin. And so Dad moved over there and rented that place, made like 145 acres to farm that year, and put it all in cotton. And we did well enough that that year, 1938, well, that fall, well, he bought it and paid $1,000 down on it, Christmas of 38, and took off and had a new pickup. He bought a new Ford pickup at the time. And so somehow or other, I don't remember what kind of a cab over or thing over the back. Anyway, there was some kind of a box built on the back end of it, and we went back to visit to Oklahoma that Christmas, for Christmas that year. And then we came back, and in 38, while he'd bought, we finally got us a milk cow to milk. That was a dream, man, have your own milk, where you didn't have to go buy milk them days, and that way you'd have hogs and butcher your own hogs and do everything like we did back east, back in Oklahoma. Anyway, in 39, we got into more hogs. He bought them. He really went to feeding out hogs, working to raise hogs, and bought a few steers. We'd taken, he sold the alfalfa, about half the place in alfalfa. We'd sell the alfalfa until July, and then we'd bale it up, and he'd bought a hay baler, and those kids was big enough to fork hay into a baler, and with Mom driving the tractor and him tying out, and one man working for him, why, we farmed that 145 acres, and taking them baled hay on out on the side quite a bit, three or four days a week. And at the end of that year, 1939, that place was paid for. And I hadn't paid too much for it, I think $16,000. But anyway, to pay for 160 acres of land in a year's time was a pretty good accomplishment back then even. And today, well, there's no way you could, you know, to pay the prices they could now, you'd have to sprout gold to have done it, but paid for it in a year's time. And we all worked, and oh heck, well, what the heck, why? We worked like mad, and when we got all of our work done, why, we'd take and get in a pickup, and maybe Saturday morning, and we'd go up on up around Three Rivers somewhere, and go fishing and swimming in the river, and go trout fishing, and you could go then up to just anywhere above there, above Kawea Dam in there, where you get the river, and you can catch a limit of trout. And it'd be nice, big, nice fish, too, along in there. And we'd go up there and camp out and cook out and sleep in the back of the pickup or on the ground and do that. That was, we didn't think to get off, you know. We didn't mind working hard, like going to 4-H camp. To go to 4-H camp, well, shoot, we didn't mind getting out and working our fannies off to get there, because we always got to go somewhere and we got the work done. But everybody worked, and that's what paid off in life. And or at least I think it was, but then why, we were going to school, and about then why, Before then, when folks had, we'd started going to church here in Farmersville, it's a Methodist church where we grew up in it then. And at that time, why, funny little thing about talking about people looking at the Okies, there was some people over here that came out, oh, probably in the 60s from Missouri and settled over here. And a fellow still lives, I won't mention any names, he still lives on the same place this man does, and he's up in his 80s.
You mean in the 1960s?
Yeah. No, they came out here from Missouri in 1860. His great-grandparents did.
Oh.
This fellow that's 80-some years old, his parents, it came as young children out there, and they had settled and acquired this land over here. And anyway, this little girl up there, they had two daughters and a son. And naturally, when you're 10, 12, 13 years old, you're always sweet on some gal, so I was kind of sweet on this gal. Anyway, why, she'd go home. Her mother told her that this girl went home, and she'd say, well, said to her, Mama was crying, said, well, Mama, how can they be Okies and be such nice people? But those are some of the things, you know, you go along. And then when we had this, why, my dad always had a, but you're talking, we'll go back to talking about this, class of people that was classified as Okies. Even we were calling them Okies then, you know. But we, anyway, in 39, 38 and 39, and for not all years during the war, why, we had went in and built up, I think we had 12 of these tent frames. And to get people to come and live in them to help to pick cotton, because the people would leave in the spring when the fruit would start getting ripe, where they'd go from here to Manteca and Stockton area and pick cherries. Then they would go on into Live Oak and Marysville and thin peaches and up there, and then stay and pick peaches. And then they'd come work their way back to get back here to pick cotton in the fall, come back and cut grapes, Fresno, Selma area, and then come in here then all toward the last week of September and live and want a place to live then, pick cotton until time to go back the next spring. And so we'd build up probably 12 or 14, 15 of these frames that were 12 by 14 and had tents stretched over them and had them fixed up. Actually, it wasn't too bad living. It was, put up a nice tent over it and keep it treated and have the boards up 4 foot high, and then the wall of the tent another 2.5 foot would give you 6 foot walls around the base of the thing, and fix it up with a chimney out through the side where the stove pipe to go out from a stove. And they would be Manny's wife, and most of the time, nowadays they wouldn't do it, but then there'd be anywhere from 4 to 6 people to live in one of those tents and pick cotton for us. And we've had a lot of them come in and pick cotton that way, and they'd go to, there was an old dance hall over here by the rest of farms that was called, where my wife used to live, it was called the Bloody Bucket. And they'd go to the Bloody Bucket and get drunk on Saturday nights and all this, and we've had people live in that they should have especially one that was there, and their little child, they'd left a couple of little kids, one 3 or 4 months old and one less than two, with somebody else there in the area, and they came in where they took them home. Well, the next morning the little baby was dead. And
how'd that happen?
Oh, just from these people, they just like today. How did this happen here 2 or 3 days ago, where this judge up here let these two young people out of jail for Mother's Day just this last Sunday? They go home and beat their baby to death and kill it. Same thing happened back then, only they never beat theirs to death. It just died from exposure, being out taken to the field and lack of care and stuff. And we've had, I can remember a number of two or three instances like that happening there. And just the people that shouldn't have children, just like they shouldn't have children, had them then and didn't take care of them. But then I know why folks were stuck 2 or 3 times for a funeral bill, trying to help pay for funeral pay for these children to be buried. But when that was the way it went, he had it. But anyway, that's the way you get people to come and pick cotton and work during the fall for you. And some of them would stay, and some of them were the darn nice people. Some of those same people that lived in those tents, I can remember living in those tents today, are well off and own good businesses all around the country today. And it was just a period in time that when it was that way. And as times got better, well, they worked their panties off to get somewhere. It was just something that was not caused by an individual human
thing. It was a state of the country, the way the country was. It was just hard times all over the world, I guess, at that time, looking back over history. And it was hard times with no lover of individuals. Everybody got hurt, and those individuals that had the intestinal fortitude to do better, while as times got better, they did better. Those that didn't fell by the wayside and are the ones now that are five generations and four generations welfare recipients. And soon, once they ever got on welfare, well, welfare takes all of the pride and respect that a man has about himself. Welfare is a taker away of that. That's the first thing welfare does, is take a man's pride and his respect for himself away. And once he loses that, then he can't get out of the rut. And that's why welfare survives to this day. The rest of us are for allowing it to get that way, or more guilty than the people that are on it. That's my own personal philosophy, because to get on welfare, you have to strip yourself of pride and respect for yourself, and then when you do that, then you lose all care. You don't care whether you just say, "Well, fiddle on. I can live this way, and I'm not going to try to get better." And that becomes a way of life for them. Then might as well talk about going to school. When we was in high school, in grammar school, when I graduated, there was only three boys and five girls. School's called Sundale now, but it was Oakdale then. The old man that was principal at the time, he is retired and lives in Oildale, down by where you live, Bakersfield, down there now. And he was a strict taskmaster of...
When you say grammar school, you mean junior high?
Well, I guess so would be that now. But anyway, then it was all 8 grades in three rooms. Mm-hmm. And one time was in the 8th grade, 7th grade. Old man Ripple came there. He always said he was the longest substitute teacher ever in the history of the Oakdale School, which is probably true, because there was a lady there named McPherson who was teaching. Had been hired for the principal when I was in the 6th grade. That would have been 38. And we was playing soccer, and she got knocked down and broke a hip, and he was hired for a replacement at that time, and he came out of Western Oklahoma. He was graduated from Weatherford College there around Elk City, Oklahoma, and out in that country. Anyway, he was always bragged that he was the longest substitute teacher and principal in the history of the Oakdale School. He lasted about 12, 13 years. But anyway, the incident happened there that one year when I told all the kids, all the boys, we was all 7th, 8th boys, we was talking about, 7th and 8th grade boys, we was going to ditch Halloween and ride our bicycles up to Rocky Hill over here east of Exeter, which would have been a good day. So it took all day to done it. So he sat there about a week, 10 days before, when he heard the rumor going around through school we was going to do this. Well, he said, boys, he said, the word to wise, is always sufficient, and I would caution anyone who ditched school on Halloween to not do it and not go to Rocky Hill and ditch school that day. He said, might be severe consequences. And he said, a word to the wise is sufficient. And that was one of his famous sayings that way, is a word to the wise. So I went on, and they was, when he did that, he scared me half to death, because I figured, that old man, because I'd seen him give some other boys a whipping at school. I didn't want one of them whippings like he got. Anyway, a bunch of them, 5 or 6 of them, did ditch school and went to Rocky Hill on Halloween's day. So came back, and there wasn't anything said for a week, 10 days after they got back. And boy, it all calmed down, and everybody was bragging and said, man, we did that and got away with it. There ain't nothing going to happen. So one afternoon, time to get out of school, he let school out a few minutes early, and he said he was letting everybody out and giving lessons for homework to do that night and stuff. He said, Paul, would you stay after school a minute? I would like to talk to you. So next morning, riding to school, I come along, and here's Paul going along. He couldn't sit down on the seat of his bicycle or nothing. He is standing up, pumping that bicycle to school. When he got to school, he was walking kind of cagey, easy around school. Went in to sit down in class, and when the school bell rang at 8:45, and kind of eased himself down into the bench. And he was looking around at Paul. well, what happened to him? And so soon first recess come, when everybody ganging up, Paul, what's the matter with you? Why are you walking so easy for? He says, well, you'll find out. And he wouldn't tell us what had happened. But some of them boys was beginning to get an idea. And so I went on, and 4 or 5 days, a week later, he said, Red, would you? There was another boy's name. We called him Red. He had red hair and Marsh Truett. And he said, and he never did call him Red. He always called him Marsh. He said, Marsh, would you stay after school tonight? I want to talk to you. Next day, Marsh was walking around awful easy and sitting down. It was after, took him till Christmas and after to get all them boys got their licking, but each one of them about once a week got it. And I mean, that old man knew how to lay a strap on your penny. He had one that did a little over 1/2 inch wide, and he doubled that thing up, and it's 6 foot long. When he doubled that thing up, brought it down, he knew how to take and make your pants hot. And each one of them old boys, he got one good licking out of that. And that was another one of his lessons that I thought, well, got me for always listening. When somebody said, a word to the wise is sufficient, that's when your ears should get straight up and down and listen. And so that's always been a thing I've looked at. No matter what, somebody used that words to me, and I heard him, well, a word to the wise is sufficient. It was time to sit up straight and listen to what's going on around you. But he was honest about it, and that's the only way he could do it today. I guess the old man would be in jail if he'd have whipped anybody that way today. But he was a good teacher. He taught us some. He was a strict states' rights constructionist. And in teaching you the Constitution, everybody has to pass the Constitution test. While I'm doing that, teaching you history, he taught it that way. And I guess that would be wrong today to teach that way, because he taught you a philosophy. When you went through 3 grades under him, you had developed most of them had thoughts on the way government should be. You were either a pretty much of a states' writer or constructionist that way or something. You believed in states' rights and believed in the government and our form of government, because that's what he taught you. And he was really emphatic and strict about it. It just wasn't something, well, here, this is the way they do it nowadays. The way my kids went through it was, they needed to. I think all kids needed that old man to be gone through for on the Constitution test and teach you the way of the government. I think we'd be better off if we had had that always through. But anyway, that's the way he was. And when we got to high school, when the old kids want to play football, well, the war broke out. Well, I was a sophomore, I guess. When it broke out in 1941, I graduated from high school. You know, it was, anyway, when World War II broke out, I was that way, and they didn't have no football lights. You couldn't end the football season. But anyway, in baseball, I got to go out for baseball and football, and it was all restricted, a lot of restricted. Wasn't like it is today, no 11 games and 25, 30 baseball games. In baseball, we played, got to maybe play one game a week somewhere else, and the rest of the time it was when we could coerce our parents into furnishing the gas and transportation to get somewhere. And other than that, it was just inter-squad games that way. But my brother and I did get to go out. And when I graduated and gone out in 44 and had got to play quite a bit of football that way. And brother, he went on and had got to play. And he played on the teams of when Bob Mathias went through. He was a year ahead of Bob Mathias, and he played 2 years in after the war with Bob Mathias, and Bob then played 1 year after he did. But he had,
where was that at?
In Tulare Union High School. And but anyway, we got to go out for sports, and we lived 9 miles from town. And if we got through and got out there in time, there used to be a fellow that had a men's store in Tulare named McCourt, and they lived in Porterville. And then the other fellow that owned Leggett's, it was a ladies' store then, and now it's a general, I guess it's still basically a ladies' store. But anyway, Leggett's, there was Leggett's and McCourt, and they both lived in Porterville. And if my brother and I would happen to get off football, out of practice or baseball practice, and got out there and was walking, getting started toward home, walking and running, well, they didn't have no buses for us to ride, and we had no car. It was thumb a ride or walk at 9 miles or trot it or run it. And why, if we got out there just right, why, McCord or maybe most, a lot of the time, well, we got a hitchhike, go right home with McCord or with Leggett. They worked at the store until just about time football practice, and my mother had bought our clothes there at those two stores. And so they'd pick us up, and we'd get a ride to go home, which saved in that because we always had to do chores when we got home and everything. But we did get to go out for sports that way, and we were in FFA and different things that way. So high school was just as, for us, well, it was just like any other kid. It was like today, there's no segregation or anything that way in high school that way.
Except that when you went home, you had to do your work.
Yeah, we had to do our work. All farm boys did. When they went home, there was a lot of farm boys that their dads had dairies, and they didn't get to go out for sports and stuff like that. But we had hogs, and we had a few cows, and they never did have too many cows, 8 or 9, 5 or 6, something like that, to milk. Didn't take long, but those chores had to be done when we got home. And it wasn't didn't get out of school them days at no 2 o'clock either to go practice football. You got out of school at 4 o'clock, and football practice was from 4 o'clock until dark. And usually dark was 6:30, quarter to 7, and sometimes later, according to how that coach was. We had the coach that became famous then at Fresno State was Pete Biden. He became a very famous baseball coach then through Fresno State in later years, but he was our high school football and baseball coach when we were in high school. And he was quite a taskmaster. So if he didn't like what was going on, he didn't give a damn if it was 8 o'clock. You still got out there, and that's when you got through. But anyway, we got to go out for sports, which a lot of other kids didn't get to do, and we participated and had a lot of fun at it that way. And then I went into service. I never got to graduate. I graduated and got a diploma, but I was old enough, and as soon as I was 18, I was put into service. And
what year was that?
1945. I didn't get in but then they passed the law. About the time I got out of basic training, they passed the law that no 18-year-olds could be sent off into combat. Anyway, by then, while the war was had been won in Europe, and it was winding down in Japan, I was put into whether they got the law through or not, but anyway, I was in the armada that was forming for the land strike on Japan when they dropped the atom bombs in August of 45. So I never did have to wait ashore and do no fighting. We was diverted, I was sent into the Philippine Islands and served in the rest of my term there in the Philippine Islands while I was in the Army that stretch. And then I was came home and got out for a little while, and things didn't go right. Anyway, I went back for another 2 years and served 2 more years in the service. And
where did you serve that?
At Camp Stoneman up by San Francisco. And all I did up there was play football and goof off up there. But I played football over in the Philippines for the last year I was there and traveled all over. I got a detached duty and played with Clark Air Force Base and traveled all over the islands over there with them, and also with the battalion that first was a battalion there that I was assigned to. It was a heavy automotive maintenance battalion, and they was scattered from Manila to Dagupan, almost the full length of the island of Luzon. And played football. And then I came back and was out a while. Went back in and played up here at Camp Stoneman. And tried out with the 49ers. And I had been injured and had a leg injured. And I never couldn't make it past the physical up there on account of a leg injury. But I thought I was pretty much a cat around amongst the boys them days. So life was that way. And came home and got out and got married, and we raised 4 children.
Now, how did you meet your wife?
Oh, I knew her. How did we meet? First time I seen her, she was probably 7 years old.
So you kind of grew up together then?
Yeah, well, I watched her grow up. part of the time I'm 5 years older, and part of the time I'm 4 years older than she is. 5 and 6, I guess it is. Right now, I'm 6 years older than she is.
So what year did you get married?
We got married in 1950, July the 12th, 1950. And so that makes us maybe married coming up 31 years. And And but I was trying to, you answered about, want to know about meeting her. Back then we belonged to everybody, they had the Farmersville Grange, and all the farmers around here belonged to the Grange, you know, and that was a good family clean place to go for relaxation. They had
it's like a lodge,
it's a fraternal organization of farmers who anyway they, but they also, the Grange in its inception back years ago was it helped get rural electrification. It worked to get that done. It worked to get a fair railroad rate fees. They established railroad rate fees. They established help work and get the irrigation projects, reclamation law. So it's an organization for fraternal things, and also it works in lobbying for betterment of farmers. Not so much anymore, but back in the history of it has been a strong lobbying organization for farmers. And anyway, it was a nice place to go for the family. They had we had some members that could play square dance music, and they did that, and the kids could dance. And then they had a junior Grange. They established a junior Grange in 1940. Yeah, and then on July 4th of 1940. I knew the wife had been, I knew her all for a couple of years. She was born in 32, so I probably knew her when she was 6 years old. Anyway, Junior Grange takes you from 5 through 14, and I was just at the break-even point. And so I was one of the older kids that had been in and forming the juvenile Grange, and she was one of the younger ones. But anyway, we was in that way, and we were both elected for that year when he organized it in July 4th, 1940. We was both elected officers in the juvenile Grange, and we grew up that way in the Grange and doing things that way and different things that way. And so we've known each other basically most of our lives and that way. And so that's how I met her.
This is session 2, tape 2 of an interview with Charles M. Newsom by Michael Neely for the California State College Bakersfield, California Odyssey Project at 25199 Road 164, Visalia, California, 93277 on May 12, 1981 at 9 a.m.
But getting back to the Grange, I was the Grange officers that start down instead of a president, where you have a master, you have 13 officers, and the women can. There's 3 officers reserved strictly for women, and anyone can hold any of the other officers. There's another one more officer that should be a man. There's the steward should be a man, but that's not the assistant steward should be a man, but that's not always possible either. But anyway. There's 3 officers in the Grange, strictly reserved. No one can hold those 3 officers except women, and those are Pomona, Flora, and Ceres. And when you do degree work and when you get into the subordinate, there's 7 degrees in the subordinate Grange, and when you go up through these 3 signify, like in old Greek mythology, each one of these has a place in it and the degree work.
Oh, is that subordinate?
Subordinate Grange. You have the subordinate Grange is the first 4 degrees. That's your local part. And then the Pomona Grange is 5th degree, and it is the county or group area. Then you have the state Grange, which supposedly operates in the 6th degree, and then the national Grange operates through the 7th degree. And this Pomona, Flores, and Ceres, each one of those, like Pomona Ceres is the 4th degree, Pomona is the 5th degree, and Flora is the thing that you honor in the 6th degree. And just in each one of those, Greek mythology comes into each one of those things and works into the secret work and the degree work of the organization. Then the 7th degree, well, that's the degree of Demeter, and that's all. The only way you get that is you have to attend a National Grange Convention, and you have to be a beholder of the lower 6th, and then you can get the 7th degree. And I've served and was elected the first master of the juvenile Grange, and then I've served as subordinate up to the Pomona. That's how I've served those 3, and ranges as master and a lot of other officers. My wife's served in many offices. And when we were, our kids were little, while they were in, my son was master of the juvenile grange, one of them. Then it had gotten where there was so few kids and they were, the interest had lagged, and they had they let our juvenile grange lapse here. But it's a grange is a good organization. It's now it's turned into mostly for senior citizens. But when we were young, it was nobody had that much money to spend going fancy places and everything. And they had a potluck and a dance or a card party or something that way. And there was always something going on that you could do that way and work around that. So we worked in the Grange that way for many years, and we did a lot of things, enjoyed, met a lot of real nice people. We still have a lot of them for friends up and down the state of California, also in the nation. But we're not very active anymore, and so...
Well, then after you got married, how did things go?
Oh, we were married the first year we got married that year, and I had, my dad and brother and I were farming, and I had 80 acres of cotton. That was my part of the farming thing that year. And we would come out that year and had a little money, and there was a funny thing. My wife don't like for you ever tell this, but anyway, we got married. Her mother, we only took 3 days if our honeymoon was gone that long, and anyway, where the wedding pictures was made, my mother-in-law went in and ordered $120-some in 1950. That was a tremendous amount of money. And ordered $120-some worth of pictures at this studio and mailed them all over to all of her and her dad and my wife's father-in-law and mother-in-law's relatives all over the United States. We didn't know these people. But anyway, she had this $120 worth of big, nice, big pictures like this made and sent all over the country, and she wouldn't pay it. Said, I had to pay it. And I said, there ain't no way I'm going to pay the bill. I said, I didn't order, and I didn't know the people he went to, and I said, they didn't care whether they got them or not, most likely anyway. And I said, I'm not sure I'm going to pay it. So went and locked on from July until cotton picking started that year. And so I started, there was nothing else to do. And I could always pick between 500 and 600 pounds of cotton a day, and they was paying $4 a hundred that fall for picking cotton. And man, I'd go out and make $20 to $25 a day, and that was big money. And so the fellow that worked for my dad, the fellow that worked for him since 1940 or 41, Big Bill Staley, we always called him, him and I picked cotton together. We'd go out and what we liked getting $3,000 a week by Friday night, that's what we picked Saturday morning. If we liked 100 pounds having it on Friday night, we'd go to the field and pick 100 pounds on Saturday morning, that's what we picked. So and take, that's $120 a week, and that was big money. And my wife, she could barely get 100 pounds a day, and she worked all fall that way, picking her 100 pounds a day till she got her pictures paid for. And she paid for them, that $127 she paid for it that fall, picking cotton that way. And I thought that, she don't like people to tell that, but anyway, that was a lot of perseverance for a little old gal. 18 years old, never had fed to pick cotton. She'd always worked in the house, but she was her mother's number one slave and taking care of raising. She had 5 younger brothers and sisters, and she always had to did housework while the others did something else. Where she stayed in the house and did the cooking, cleaning, and laundry and everything that way, and had never had to really get out and do much outside work in her life. But she got out there and picked cotton that year, and then went on, and then that was in 1950, and the next year, we still were farming the same area and there, and life progressed, and I had a couple of cows and a couple of sows, and we lived off of, would raise these winter pigs, and instead of having to take it out of the business, out of the farming thing, we could make enough money milking a couple of cows and feeding pigs that way and selling them that we could take and make enough money so we could live that way and get over to and pay for our groceries off of those selling pigs. And for chickens, I had a bunch of friends that fought chickens all over. They'd bring these wild game hens out, and half a dozen of them, and one rooster, and put them around that way, and let the old hen just set all around the place all wherever and raise these chickens, and all the pullets was mine to eat. We'd just go out with a 22, and if you'd get enough shots, shoot the head of them off with a 22, and have chicken about any time you wanted to the year that way. And
it just ran wild?
It just ran wild around the place, and... then the roosters, they'd always come and catch them. They'd get the roost, and they always had to have a barn or a tree or something for them to roost in. And when these little, they call them cocks, when they'd get 6 months old, they'd come and go to catching them. because then they'd go to sell them. They'd be worth $5 to $10, $15 a piece, and sell them for fighting purposes. And especially if they had an old rooster that was, had won five a dozen fights, and to breed these hens to, well, then made them more valuable. So we stayed the chicken that way for the first 3 years we was married. That's how we had chicken. All chicken we wanted to eat was had these friends that bought these chickens, and we'd let them raise them around the place that way. And so that's how we had fresh chicken there all the time.
When was your first child born?
In September of 1951, September 19th of, oh, I can't even think now, it was September 19th of 1951. I think that's the 19th. Yeah, that's close enough. Anyway, September 51, 19th, I think, because he has a cousin, my niece, was born on the 13th, and he was about a week younger than she was. So,
how many children did you have?
We have four. We have three boys. We had three boys. We had, the next son was born in February 53, and the next boy was born in October 54, and the next girl was born in December of 55. And they were February 19th, then on October 12th, and December the 2nd. And then that was the end of the family producing. We didn't have, that was the end of our kids. All of our kids, our daughter, youngest was 25, soon be 26, and all we got now is to worry about grandkids. They'll have enough, have some grandkids to play with. That's all we got to worry about that on that one.
Well, you have a large farm here. How did you start that?
Well, we was always in farming, and I was always in love with cows, and I had liked cows, and so in 1952, we was farming, and we had a bunch of permanent ditches, whole ditch lines that never worked in. The place was up, leveled up years and years ago, and you'd run water on the high spots, and we, instead of having to have men in there and hold these ditches, back then didn't have chemicals to spray them the way they do today, but anyway, instead of holding them, keeping the grass off of them, we bought heifers. And these 6-7-month-old heifer calves, and I'd put them on there, and when they got up big enough to breed, we bred them, and so when they went to milking, well, I started milking cows. Then I'm shipping milk from four cows. And then went on and moved to another place. When next year, in 1954, we rented a place and it had a little barn on it. And by then I was up, and I moved up and was milking about 10 or 12 cows. And you have to get up and do something in the morning before breakfast. Then I'd get up and run and milk these cows and sell the milk from them and come back in. And that way we didn't have to borrow no money. The cows would make enough money to feed themselves and keep us our groceries on our table. And you could always raise a calf to butcher and have meat that way, and a hog too. And so that's the way we did. That's how we got started in the dairy business. In 1956, well, we bought the place where we live now, and it had a dairy barn on it. And I think I was milking 17 or 18 head then. And we started on from there and built up to now, where we have milked as many as 160, but we're milking about 100, and we've got 140 head of milk cows, milking about 110 of registered Holsteins now. And from 1955 and the 26 years we've been here, where we built those registered Holsteins up to where we have one of the highest producing herds in the state of California, and we're one of only five herds that received the Progressive Breeders Award in the state of California. There's only, I think, 387 nationwide. So we have, in the 26 years since we bought the place we live on now, we've developed our herd up into where we're pretty well recognized statewide and on the national level a little bit for our production and for classification of animals and type of herd that we have.
Well, now, how much milk will one of these cows produce in a day?
Well, we're averaging 7.25 gallons right now.
A day?
Yeah, a day per cow. And we have one cow that we're test tonight. This is, May the 12th? And the test will be here tonight, the test, and we have one cow out there that this will be her fourth month on test, and she's had 128 pounds, 142 pounds, and 151 pounds.
Of milk.
On milk, a weigh day, and divide that by 8.6, and then you can see that's 17, 18 gallons of milk a day that one cow's giving. And
Well, how do you make them give so much?
Well, strictly it's by genetics have been bred in it and feeding them, and good luck and the good Lord looking out for you. It's mainly, I guess, that's...
No trick to it.
Well, yeah, I guess there's tricks to every trade. But we're not doing anything that anybody else can't do. We never had no money. I raised the four children. We put them through college off of it. My wife and I stayed home and milked the cows and farmed 80 acres of ground while all four kids was going to college. And they're on the mantle. I can show you where we have one after two of them got married. We have one time when we was taking care of six kids in Cal Poly at one time. So supporting them mostly.
Well, not yours?
Well, two daughter-in-laws and four of mine. Two oldest boys had got married, and we were basically supporting them. They were working and helping to a certain degree, but we were also the main support for all six of them. And that one year, and we have those in there, and they all have better than a 3.2 grade average at that one time.
You seem kind of to have a scientific attitude towards the breeding of these cattle. Where did you get that experience, that know-how?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if we have any scientific. I guess when you go to the School of Hard Knocks and the professor's name experience, well, you learn as you go.
Well,
I've always been, you would say, of an inquiring nature and curiosity. I go to meetings where I'll be the only nut that'll get up and ask all kind of questions because I don't understand things sometimes, that's the only way I can understand and find out things is asking questions. And I've always asked questions. I've also read and tried to read a lot. I've read everything I could ever get my hands on about how other people had bred up herds of cows to develop them and what they had done and tried to ask questions of how they did it, you know, when I could talk to them personally, if they'd talk to you and would answer it. But as I said, we never had no money to ever go and buy any big animals, no animals. The only thing after we bought the start, we bought our 10 animals from Joe Bono to start in two different times.
Joe Bono?
Yeah, Joe Bono. He has a dairy out west of Tulare. Had purebred cows, and we bought two different, bought four one time and eight another time. I guess it was 12. And that's where we got to start. And they weren't always, they weren't the best cows. We bought whatever. One time I got some picking on it, but the other time it was just cows. And we tried to breed them to the best bulls. We've used artificial insemination. And there's always, if you try to get it, there's always been bull proofs and things that you could use and try to get there and to be able to increase your herd. Just you've got to always, only one race of things on God's earth that don't breed for improvement of the next generation, and that's a human. All other animals have a selection process of some kind that for improvement of the species for the next generation, except the human race, and the human race is the only one that doesn't do that, because we're, with our tender hearts or whatever it is, why we're always striving to survive, to keep the weak and the ail that way for any other species, why it always dies. The weak and those, why they have to be thrown away, and that's the way in breeding cows. You've got to get rid of, you just can't never be in love with them, one of them. You got to, if it just don't produce, you got to throw her away and do something else, because you can't regenerate and keep going on with that weakness. You got to, the only one thing to do is that, just throw it away and get rid of it and start out with something else.
Well, you can use it.
No.
Can you use her for meat?
What I mean, though, you don't ever breed it to regenerate the race on down to, because once it has something wrong with it, why? If it don't produce enough milk, or if the type's bad, why? Yeah, and then you've got to abandon that and try to get into the other. But there's always the point to prove the point. Like we have an old cow out here that is she only classified 79 points, which is only good, and It's not, well, very good, but the old cow is 220,000 pounds lifetime. She has 8 daughters in the herd that are some of our highest producing cows. They're not the highest classified, but they're all classified way better than she is in plant type, and they all produce.
Why did you keep her?
Well, it was one of those things. At the time, we had to have the milk, and she gave a lot of milk. And the first calf she had was a heifer, and it was something else. And it was one of those cases where the old cow had some breeding power. She herself was not a fancy individual, but she had the genes in her that would have been thrown away and should have been thrown away. But she had, with that first heifer, you could see the genes where that she was breeding on, and when she had the second heifer the next year, then it definitely was a case of, well, that old cow may not be, that may be not like a something else. She just may not be pretty, but she's sure getting pretty. And so we've kept her that way, and she's 14 years old, and she's going to have to go. She's getting all stove up, and this is the end of her. See, this year, she'll go to, we'll have to sell her and do something with her, get rid of her, because she's all crippled. They're getting crippled up. And
you sound like you've gotten attached to her.
Well, you don't get really attached to her, but you respect her for what she's done. But now she's getting a little arthritis, and she don't get around real good, I've put her on down the road, get her out of her misery, and I don't want her to stand around here. No, she might live 5 years, but stand around and hurt and stay where she's not in good, thrifty condition and hurt all the time. It's just a more humane thing to let her go down and somebody have a nice Wendy's hamburger or something that way. And
is that what you do? You sell her for meat?
Yeah, we sell them for beef, and I don't know where they go into. I always say they go to McDonald's or Wendy's or Jack in the Box or somewhere that way, or Taco Bell.
Well. That's economy. It's
economy thing. It's a lot better to get $600 for them than to see them stand out there and suffer and die.
Yeah.
And
then have to have them hauled off.
Yep. Well, Tyler works haul them off that way, and that's not humane. I don't think letting an animal stand out there and suffer for a year or two when she's in misery. And only people get that privilege. All animals lie. At least most people, when they have an animal or a pet that way, when it suffers, then they do something about it to get it out of its suffering. And I firmly believe that. I don't think that you should leave an animal standing around suffering. It should be, when it worked for you these years, well, when it starts suffering, why get its own over out of its suffering.
Let's just look back, kind of finish things up. How do you feel about everything that's happened to you?
I've lived a wonderful life. Let's see, how would you want to put it in a summation? I went visiting back to Oklahoma here a few years ago, and there was a cousin that I thought the world of. Back when before we came out here, he was from December to February younger than I was, and him and his mother was my first cousin, but she was almost as old as my mother. And they were real good friends and grew up to my mom. I was 4 or 5 years, 6 years older than she was, and he raised Aunt this Mabel, and Edward and I were real good friends. We went back there. The first things he said when we walked in were, are they still picking money off the trees out there in California? And that was always something that made me kind of halfway mad, because nobody picked no money off the trees unless they first sweated for it. And then look back in my life and my father's and mother's and brother's life. We want to say, we'd like to brag and say, well, everything we've got, well, we've worked and earned for it. But you could only earn and work and acquire what the good Lord will let you acquire, and that way. And that's for everybody. But you have to also put yourself out a little bit. But California has been good to a lot of people. And now then, when we look at the South San Joaquin Valley, and many, many of the better businessmen, better farmers, politicians, or everything that way, just like up here in the next congressional district north of us. Bernie Sis served for 24 years in the assembly, And he was he rode the rails out here from Texas. That's how he got to California. And there's a couple of supervisors here serving in Visalia now that they came out at a little later stage from back in Oklahoma, Texas, to this country. One of them has an orange grove over here south of Exeter, and the other one has a clothing store and comes out of Dinuba. And that's just here in Tulare County, and I'm quite sure when you get into Kern County, there's a number of politicians that have served that way. I believe Harlan Hagen was one of the boys that came out of the back east that way and served here in the congressional district from down there for a long, long time ago. And there's big farmers. There's a lot of farmers. This Hollis Camp, who came out here and turned into the Camp Farms, I think he was one of those that came here in the 30s and worked his fanning off to acquire. And then there's people in oil. I don't know. I'm quite sure that there's been a real tremendous impression made on the southern San Joaquin Valley by the Okie migration out here of the 30s, and as well as there's been other ethnic backgrounds. We can call it an ethnic background, I think, as well as you could call an Italian or Portuguese or anything else an ethnic background, that have had a tremendous impression on southern San Joaquin Valley, also the state of California.
Yeah, they're people just like you.
And I think we've had on it, and some of them have become highly respected members of their community. And
I look at you, I'm impressed.
And, well, I don't mean for anybody, but I thank you for the compliment. And I look back and I think that no one can be ashamed of what's happened. There's nothing to be ashamed of. And hold their head high and progress on forward. And
you don't feel that life has treated you poorly?
No. Mm-mm.
It's been okay. Huh?
It's no way. We'll take some of the ethnics now, races. We can take the Mexicans, and we can take especially those who are, they're the ones and the colored people who are hauling discrimination. They're not in this area. The Spanish are descended, or the Mexican, or the Negro has never been treated any worse than we were when we first came here. When we first came here to this country in the 30s, why, the Negro people, you Okies that was already here, they looked down on us, and they were, I have some very good colored Negro friends that own property and came out here, back when oil was struck in Oklahoma and Texas, they were Indian mixed breed. And they came to California even before, and they owned a lot of land. And some of those people are just as nice people there, but they all looked down on us at the time. And it's a matter of getting your head up and saying, hey, I can be just as good as anybody, and ain't nobody no better. I'm no better either. And so
they don't look down on you now, do they?
No, but some of them do, but that's neither here nor there. They'll always look down. There's always people looking down their nose at somebody else, but I don't have the empathy really for these ethnics hollering discrimination the way they are and not trying to do something about it. Now, I look around and see a whole bunch of Mexican and Spanish descendant people, those that are working, like the Cepeda brothers. They've got a big dairy down here, and there's another one over there, Torres, and then Sanchez. They've all got big operations, and then there's many more that I can't think of that have been, and then in business, those that have said, hey, I can do this, and went on. But the white ethnic on teaching and reason that the black man and or colored man or the Mexican and them is down there is that they have believed the white theory that they are inferior. The white people say, hey, you're black, you're Mexican and brown, you're inferior. You just can't hack it. Well, those that believe that stay in that social level. Those that say, hey, I'm just smart as you are, those are up in there, and they, like Phil Sanchez up here at Fresno, one of the brighter young lights out of Fresno up there, and a whole bunch more of them that you could go through and name.
You're really talking about yourself, though, back in those days.
Yeah, I'm talking about myself, but I'm talking of something that they can do, that there's no such thing as ethnic background holding you down. Today, there's just as much opportunity in this country as there was any time since we have been a country, if you'll look for it and get with it.
And that's what you did.
And we think we did that, well, we hope we did, and there's many others who've done the same thing.
But when they tried to put you down, it didn't work.
They just put us down, but it didn't really work. We said, well, there's no way you're going to keep us down. We're going to keep going. And I think that's what needs to be done today. People need to take a little self-pride in themselves and say, hey, just because you say I'm dumb, that's a bunch of hooey. I'm just as smart as you are, and I'm going to show you. And when they do that, then there's no keeping that person down.
It took more than just work, though. It took courage.
Courage, and those people, everybody's got that courage.
You seem very positive about people.
Well, I'm very positive about, like I said, about the time you say you're positive about something is the time you turn up to be a nut. There's no such thing as getting too positive. Because once you say, hey, I ain't going to do that, that's the very thing you're going to be doing tomorrow. But I firmly believe these things, though, that if you will do these things, you can acquire and do this and be a success.